If Didier Deschamps were to leave and Zinedine Zidane were available and he was not picked by the French Federation, the headquarters of the French Federation would have to look at what happened at the Bastille.
OTB AM, live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
7:30 Friday morning. Welcome along to OTB AM. Adrian here, Owen there.
How are you, Adrian?
I know. How's the form? Good to see you now. This is a departure for us.
Yeah.
Been a few weeks.
Going to do 4 minutes of work this week as opposed to three.
You survived anyway.
I did. We're back.
And I have a great story to tell. It'll be another chapter in your book, obviously.
The story's been beaten to death at this point.
Move on. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. It was a very boring story in the first place.
It wasn't, to be fair. It was a great story. And I don't know. And there was a lot of people pointing it out when we were chatting last week. Had we fully gotten to the bottom, really, of what was going on?
I accept
that as a journalist, that's a failing on my part.
Man misses plane.
You know, but we're burying the lead here. That's sort of what I'm slightly concerned about.
There are people right now missing planes and they're not getting the coverage. Some people just get different coverage to other people. Some people just get... There's a media bias.
It's funny that, all right? It's funny that. It just depends on your point of view. Some of you've got a PR machine working on one side and then you've got the reality somewhere else. And everybody's got their own little axe grinder on it, right? We're making some sort of covert points here that we're going to get into in just a second. We've lots coming up on the show this morning and tell you all about that in a few minutes. But definitely, you were out at the Stephen Kenny press conference yesterday, Owen. This is all intriguing now, isn't it? Like, just to see how all of this plays out. Everybody's hanging on every word that Stephen Kenny has to say. And, you know, he's... whatever he says is pretty measured, one way or the other, whichever side of the camp you're on.
I think so. And there is this sort of phony war that's going on at the moment where people are relatively entrenched in positions. And I'm not talking about media here at all. I'm talking about nationally and how this team is being viewed. And every single international window that happens, maybe it moves the needle one way or the other. But until he sits down with FAI chiefs in November and until that new contract is sorted out, I think we will still exist in this phony war where maybe there is a bizarre result here or there that does change things significantly. But I actually think that we will get to November and Kenny will get to those talks and we will be none the wiser about how things will go. As I say, the caveat there is some extraordinary results, either negative or positive, over the next two windows that may actually shift things. But I think we're in this stasis now, which is probably going to exist for the next 6 weeks or so. So buckle up for a lot of interesting coverage over the next little while. And I would say it's about a manager who's getting a little bit better at dealing with this sort of stuff as well. I think his performances are a little bit more polished than they were at the start. Not that that makes a difference on any level whatsoever, because the results are ultimately what is going to define the legacy of Stephen Kenny, you suspect.
You would like to think that if results start to go his way, right, that everybody gets won over. I don't believe that would actually happen. I genuinely believe that even if results come back, and it's not, we're never going to be in a position, no matter who is playing or coaching us, where we're going to go out and be like England and, you know, beat everybody around us in our qualifiers and then sort of, you know, come up short in the tournament itself. But we're never going to be in that position where we're going to be that dominant. It is always going to be about trying to scrape results here or there. So in that context, I genuinely believe that even if results start to turn for the current management ticket, that there will still be a large cohort of people who are just not going to buy it. They're not into it. They're not having it. They've set out their stall. And again, this is obviously, this is just a general public point. I think that there are a whole pile of people who don't want to be won over by this. They've decided that Stephen Kenny is not the guy they want in place. And even if results start to go our way, because my view on that is results going our way is that we managed to get a draw here or there. We beat the teams we should be beating. Obviously, everybody accepts that you got to be beating the likes of Azerbaijan and Luxembourg, etc. But I genuinely believe that even if those types of results start to come in, that there is going to be a decent cohort of the people who are currently in the anti-Kenny side, let's call it, that are going to just remain there.
I would say that's true for this window. Like, beating Azerbaijan and Qatar maybe won't change the opinion of a number of people. I don't think that's true for the final window. I do think there is a large cohort of Irish supporters who are results-based. And I think that's fair enough. I absolutely understand why you could be a results-based supporter or follower of Irish football. And if they change, I actually suspect that more people will be on board with this. I guess what people who are supportive of Kenny and people who want to see him stay are clinging to is that the performances and the direction in which he has taken this team will lead to results down the line. Everybody realises that it is a results game, and some people realise that these results aren't going to come for quite some time with this current playing group, and other people believe that actually the results should have already happened because this current playing group maybe could have been staffed with a few more experienced players. For example, if you look at the current squad and these games were there for the taking now, the games that Ireland lost over the last little while were there for the taking now. So I to a certain degree, Adrian, I can understand why people are looking at the results and saying, listen, this isn't going in a great direction right now. And I do think that if the results change, that will get a lot more people on board. Not everyone, obviously. I think you're right about some people, but I still think there are a number of floating voters who can be persuaded by a couple of wins over the next couple of months.
I agree with that. Look, you've put the poll to Stephen Kenny, and it features in some of the papers today that there's that 80%...
The off-the-ball poll, apparently.
The off-the-ball poll, yeah.
Apparently it's an off-the-ball poll.
Represented by an off-the-ball journalist. That, you know, it's 80% for and 20% against. I suppose my point is that you might end up with 10% of them being won over by the results, and then the other 10% are like, listen, he's just not for me. And I guess that's fine. We want to look at some of the papers. We'll do that in a second. I'll tell you what, first of all, we'll take a bit of a clip of Stephen Kenny yesterday. You were out there, Abbottstown, obviously going through his paces, squad named. Here he is on the need to turn those draws into wins.
I think the main statistic we're looking for against Azerbaijan is to win the game, and we need to turn our draws into wins. I think if it was to have that conversation, it's a long conversation, yeah. And I think from my point of view, that's what we need to do. We've obviously the last window, it's very intensive, three games, 6 days, very tough physically against Portugal, obviously losing in the 96th minute. Azerbaijan and Serbia games, and I thought it were three very exciting games, and but we obviously want to turn a number of the draws we've had into wins, and we should have done that, and we haven't, so we just need to find a way of doing that now.
That win them all over, that's what we're saying here, right? I just want to give you a bit of a flavour. We'll come back to do the papers in more depth later on, but just a bit of a flavour of what's happening around the coverage this morning, and just how the press conference yesterday has been reported. So Aidan Fitzmaurice in the Irish Independent this morning. Kenny, new deal, not a worry. So this is just the Ireland boss insists he's not fixated on contract as he picks Wigan's Keane for Azerbaijan trip. So that's the contract that's due up in July of next year. And the Sun then, it's Owen Cowser here. Football focus. Kenny not sweating over Ireland future. Talk is cheap, says Paul O'Hare in the Mirror this morning. Kenny focusing on actions and results rather than the discussions on his future. So you can get, I'm trying to show you there's a bit of a vibe there of give this guy a bit of a break, give him a bit of time. Kenny hopes to add keen edge to Irish attack. Gavin Comiskey was at the press conference yesterday. That's the Irish Times view. So that's generally how that's reported across the Irish papers this morning. And then we come to the Irish Daily Mail this morning, which leads with Kenny hits back at McGrath, writes Philip Quinn inside. And then on the Star as well, bam, 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 Kenny, I will show McGrath. So that's how that's reported. He was asked yesterday about the comments of Paul McGrath. What are these Kenny hits back at McGrath comments, you ask yourself, that he's so strongly lashed back at? And how dare he question an Irish legend? Listen, says Stephen Kenny, Paul McGrath is an Irish legend. There's no doubt about it. I don't think he was overly critical. I think he also said he hoped I proved him wrong, or I may prove him wrong, and that's certainly the intention, says the Republic of Ireland manager. Everyone is entitled to an opinion, and that's the nature of football, particularly international football, but I've no major issue. That's the Stephen Kenny hits back at Paul McGrath comments. Now, anybody who's paid any attention to what Stephen Kenny has said at any point over the last couple of years will realise that he doesn't really hit back at anybody. That's his shtick. That's the way he's going about his business. They are very, for me, misleading headlines in terms of what's going on inside the piece. And interesting, Owen, that's how it's reported this morning, that, there's... newspapers are always going to mourn ourselves. You'll take your different angle on a piece, and what's the most interesting bit or the most juicy bit? But, we've gone from on the back page of the Star, Kenny, I will show McGrath. Now, that's not the worst, but Kenny hitting back at McGrath in the Mail just feels like a bit of a bridge too far for me.
I think Kenny's on an occasion or two already set a stall out and has been quite passionate in his defence of the team. Was it after the last international window in particular where he was particularly staunch in his defence of his team, I think it's fair to say. Whereas yesterday it did feel that, you know, there was an O'Gray question thrown at him and he answered it how you're supposed to answer it. He's a legend, etc., etc. Like,
you're never going to start a war with Paul McGrath.
Not. Like,
that's not a not, well, you know, that 20% that we're talking about.
But I don't think he's even. I'm not even sure if he's even thinking that. I'm sure he saw some of the comments, and like, McGrath's not a fan of Stephen Kenny and what he's done so far. I think Kenny's right in what he's saying, and that McGrath wants to be won over. He wants to see the best for Ireland. He's got a different view to a lot of people on Stephen Kenny. And to be honest with you, like, I think that's fine. I absolutely. Paul McGrath thinks that. I think that's absolutely fair enough. He's always going to have a platform because he is an absolute legend of the game. And I think hearing all these different views is good. Like, what can obviously irk a lot of people is if there is a little bit of, I don't know, ill will in terms of actually trying to push this out to be a sort of war of words more than it actually really is. Paul McGrath doesn't think Stephen Kenny is doing a particularly good job with the Ireland national team. Stephen Kenny disagrees.
Yeah, and then inside the column from Philip Quinn here, as for Stephen Kenny, no doubt he appreciated the warmth of a timely poll from off the ball, which revealed that 80% of 1,000 respondents are supportive of him as Republic of Ireland manager. Where was the poll from?
Not off the ball. I'm
somewhere else.
Yeah.
The public poll followed a rare media appearance, and this is the interesting bit. The public poll followed a rare media appearance this week, also on the News Talk show, by the Ireland assistant manager Keith Andrews, in which he hailed Kenny as a visionary. That Andrews should choose as a station sympathetic to Kenny, and against a backdrop of speculation regarding the manager's future, was no coincidence.
Ireland thinks is the survey. Sorry, just to give him the credit.
That Andrews should choose a station sympathetic to Kenny was no coincidence. I mean, that Andrews should choose a station that he trusted, or a media outlet that he trusted to carry his words in a fair and balanced way, I think is probably the story here. Also, he worked for Off the Ball for 18 months. I think that he obviously has a good rapport. Like, there's a real suggestion here that the interview... Sorry, there's not a suggestion. I'll follow on with the quotes here. It's actually written in black and white. If it was a choreographed PR strategy by Kenny and his handlers to gain sympathy and understanding from the public, the tactics made sense given the plight of the Ireland boss. Will it earn him a new deal? So to suggest that Keith came in here as a PR job and that we facilitated the PR job, like, you just really have to look at the interview to figure out it wasn't a PR job. There was some very tough questions asked of Keith Andrews. He answered them, I think, extraordinarily well, as is typical of the man. And I just feel that there's a real insinuation here that, you know, Off the Ball was facilitating some sort of a PR job on behalf of, because we're sympathetic, it says here, to Stephen Kenny, that we are facilitating a PR job on behalf of the senior management team. Really feels like a stretch. And I mean, you just got to watch 50 minutes of the interview with Keith Andrews, where he really is put through his paces on very specific stuff by Joel during the week, to figure out that it wasn't really a PR job.
No. I think we need to offer balance in this discussion. We don't know what sort of relationship Joe has with Keith Andrews and Stephen Kenny. Maybe tickling his belly and maybe they play a lot of golf together is exactly what they do. I mean, who are we to say at the moment? Maybe there is a secret engine powering all of us here in order to try and reflect positively, and positively only, on what's happening with Ireland at the moment.
Yeah, look, I think it's important for us to say this morning that is not... what happened with that piece. It was not a fluff PR piece. It wasn't like he came in and, like you said, had his belly tickled. It was uncomfortable at times. And I would agree with the point that I do think that Keith Andrews and Stephen Kenny come out the better of it, to be honest with you. But I think that's what happens when somebody who doesn't, like Keith, hasn't done a lot of pieces, that comes up over the course of the interview. He hasn't done a lot of interviews. And then he chooses to do one. And I do think that it helps explain their positioning and where they're coming from all the better.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, yeah. There's absolutely no need to be coming out doing interviews if you don't want to. Like, I don't understand. Like, I'd like to think that people can maybe make their own mind up about that if they've watched all the interviews, if they've seen the coverage and can maybe see if it's fair coverage or not, rather than seeing whether or not this is a PR job, because that would certainly suggest that is the MO here, that it is to provide positive PR. I think it's just been a constant tone for sure. I think if he said that maybe there's been a hopeful tone about this reign, that maybe future results are forthcoming, I think he could possibly be right in saying this, but actually crafting some sort of positive PR for no reason whatsoever, I think that's probably a little bit wider than Mark.
Mm. Now, we've also been on a PR drive over the last 12 months.
Now, this is a PR drive. This is a PR drive now.
Football legend.
Well, not us, of course. Our colleague has been, you know, wingmanning.
Yeah, well, look, it's us. Let's put ourselves right at the centre of the story here, Owen. We've been giving a lot of positive PR to Andy Moran over the last 12 months, and it has landed him the Leitrim job. That's the lead story on some of the back pages. It's not. Mayo legend Moran set to take over the reins from Highland in Leitrim. Big story, Conor McCone here in the back of the Irish Independent this morning. Andy Moran set to become the new Leitrim manager. 2017 Footballer of the Year has been linked with a number of vacant inter-county positions in the past few weeks. Most recently Longford, which was a bit that... I mean, I know that Longford doesn't tend to get, let's call it the credit it deserves or the discussion it, you know, maybe deserves or maybe doesn't. But that had slipped me for sure. But Andy Moran, it looks as though I was about to take the... Leitrim gig on. It's a really interesting thing. He's one of the best footballers of a generation. He's dipped his toe in the whole management thing with Balladreen, himself and Barry Solon over the last couple of years, in fact, over the last year. And now it feels like this is a guy who's Mayo manager in the making, right? And this is a stepping stone to that.
Yeah, 100%. And I think this will be a very shrewd move were there to be a certain change to the championship structures later on this year. I think it was Tommy actually watching Leitrim against Mayo earlier on this year in the championship, and it really felt like the day when the conversation around the championship structure exploded. There is always one day every summer where the championship structure conversation comes right back into view, and it really felt that the hocking that Leitrim took this year was that day. So it's kind of fitting that he's going in to actually, I guess, see first of all what a county like this has to deal with, and second of all to try and actually take them back to some level of competitiveness. And whether or not that's with Mayo down the line, and I'm talking well down the line, remains to be seen. But hopefully next year there will be a world in which Leitrim can compete for something meaningful at their own level. And of course, I think it's mentioned in the piece in The Independent, there is one Mayo man who previously took Leitrim to some great heights in the 90s in John O'Mahony. So there will be a pathway, I'm sure, from him to follow that. But the early signs from even just listening to Andy Moran on the football pod with Tommy and Paddy is that, I mean, he thinks about the game in a very intelligent way, and the early signs are there from his club work as well. It's a risk. Like, I mean, it's like if you wanted a safe move into inter-county management, your first step is to go into a backroom team, isn't it, or to try and get something with Mayo. So it's a ballsy move. I like it, and I'll be very, very excited to see what actually happens, because I think, again, it comes down to other managerial talk that we have around soccer teams as well, is that people are smart enough to see the wood from the trees a little bit and to see what progress actually means. I mean, beating Mayo is never going to be a sign of progress, because it's not going to happen anytime soon. But there are progress. There's progress to be identified in other ways. And hopefully, as I say, the championship structure will allow that to happen.
It is a brave step, I think, in a lot of ways, because like Leitrim are not going to win an awful lot of games. I mean, if they win any game, they'll be doing well. They're obviously going to get into the Tailteann Cup for the teams in Division 3 and 4 who don't make a provincial final. So he's definitely got that to target. But it is a brave step. It's like, I don't know, like an Eddie Brennan to Leash type gig, in that there is a little bit of an aspect of it that is a kind of a hiding to nothing. Like if he goes in, look, maybe it is a shot to nothing, and maybe it doesn't make any difference. Maybe the expectation is that Leitrim are going to win in every game, and then anything beyond that is a bonus, and so that nobody is actually making any great judgments, other than it helps Andy Moran for a year or two to, and like, I just don't really mean to offend any Leitrim people here this morning, but that it's a stepping stone towards that Mayo gig and helps him along the path. I'd be interested to know, Balladreen and Tommy, Andy goes into it in detail in the football pod with Paddy and Andy and Tommy this week, about how they were beaten by Westport, I think it was last weekend. They have Ball upcoming this weekend, and that'll be another tomorrow in the championship as well. That'll be another one to keep an eye on. I'm interested to know if there are any Balladreenites out there, what sort of football it is that they're, that, like, what is an Andy Moran team?
Oh, it's turgid and
swashbuckling.
It's 4 points to three in every single win. The corner forwards are deployed as corner backs. There are four goalkeepers, and that is what we can expect from Leitrim next year.
Yeah, he's player manager obviously on the team, and he spoke about Lee Keegan went in on him at one point, and he said after that that was the end of days for him, I think.
And I see when the first Leitrim team sheet comes out next year, it's like, who's that new corner forward they have? Moran?
Is he do you have to sort of sit out? What are the latest UEFA regulations and all that? Listen, I think we're doing too much of a PR job here for Andy Moran. You know, we sit in the fence, and
I've tickled enough bellies this morning.
What happens. Right, speaking of the football pod with Paddy and Andy, the very latest episode is available to listen to. it's an absolute cracker. We've changed it up though this week. Andy Moran interviewing Paddy Andrews. Paddy turns the mic on Andy. Paddy goes in depth on being dropped by Pat Gilroy. We hear about Andy's coaching influences, which in the context of this morning's news will be all the more interesting. And we finally get the real story. We've talked about it lots in the past. The real story of Paddy's ill-fated transfer to Man United from the one and only Roddy Collins.
Thanks, Paddy. We're just going to leave you now with the real story from the horse's mouth of the time you nearly signed for Man United.
Well, Tommy, just a few questions for Andy to ask Paddy. Right, and I know what you're thinking. I'm out here in Spain after just arriving on my boat. But you know what? You're not wrong, Tom. You're not wrong. Andy be probably saying, that flash bastard out there in Dublin. So look, it is what it is. Anyway, more now to Paddy now. Three questions for Paddy. One of them is, Paddy made a name for himself up around Castleknock when he was a kid, before he ever put on a pair of boots. And they were called Paddy's Carnival Nights. Paddy's Carnival Nights was a big party up in the house on a regular basis. One rule, you had to take your shoes off so as you wouldn't dirty his mother's carpet. That was one of them. Another one, Paddy wore a hula hoop skirt and a hula hoop coconuts at a Hawaiian party in my house many years ago. I hope he doesn't deny that. And finally, Paddy's version of events when he signed for me is totally different the way you're going to read in my book when it comes out. Paddy came into my house, accepted my hospitality. He signed the contract. He shook me hand, he gave me a hug, he drank me tea, he had me breakfast as well. And as soon as it hit the media and bridges were kicking up, Paddy bottled it. Shame, could have been a very good player. But anyway, Andy, I am down here and it's because Mayo lost. I was built to go to Achill Island. And when he's lost last Saturday week, I just said, that's it, I'm not going to Achill. I was going to be jumping around Masterson's pub and Duggart and Martin Brennan's pub in Westport. That was my plan to enjoy Mayo winning and all, but it didn't happen. But anyway, just getting back to the boat. Your opinion on it, I think it might need a lick of paint, lads. What do you think? Well done. See you, Andy. See you, Tom.
Yeah, that is the brilliant Roddy Collins. Was he in Cannes? Was it Dunleary? We will never know. But be sure to subscribe to the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. They've got some really big interviews planned for the off-season as well. Available exclusively, by the way. Remember that first every week, every Tuesday on the OTB Sports app. The only place to get it first. Get the hop on everybody else by getting it there. And so that's that. It's 7:53 on this Friday morning. Lots of comments coming into us. We'll bring you those your way, particularly around the Stephen Kenny comments yesterday and that developing situation. We'll bring you those in a little bit. You are watching OTB AM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, what's coming up later in the show, you ask yourself? Well, just a couple of moments' time, we're going to catch up with Cormac Ryan, who's going from Achill to Athens. And it's all for charity, and we'll bring you that interview. He'll be joining us live in just a couple of moments' time. 8:10, Caoimhe O'Neill of The Athletic. It's Liverpool City, obviously, this weekend. It's a big game and off the ball, and one of the biggest games of the weekend, so we'll get Caoimhe's thoughts ahead of that. Sports pages, we'll dip back into the back pages about 8:30. Alan Quinlan after that will join us to look ahead to the weekend's rugby. We're also going to be talking about with Quinny the Irish style. That is a question that's come up over the last few weeks. What is it? What should it be? And how can we influence it? So there'll be that and a few other bits as well. And then Hector Hookagon launched his brand new show, Era New, a brilliant show on TG Carra last night. So fresh from that, we'll be joined by Hector about 9:10 this morning. We'll talk to him about Diverse Ireland in 2021 and plenty more as well besides. So if you have any comments for any of those guests, do bring them our way. And then Kathleen McNamee, who was in conversation with Nathan in the football show last night, will be with us from about 9:30.
Okay, so as you mentioned there, Cormac Ryan is in the middle of a 6,000-kilometre cycle going from Achill all the way to Athens, expected to end somewhere at the end of this month. He is fundraising for Bodywise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland, and Pieta as well. You can go to idonate.ie/Achill to Athens to donate. And we are delighted to be joined right now by Cormac himself. Cormac, good morning to you.
Morning, lads. How are things?
You are somewhere in the back arse of Austria, I suspect.
Yeah, I'm sitting here somewhere along the Danube, about 30k outside Vienna, and we're on the road to Bratislava, which is about another 40k up the road. I haven't seen a car in about 20 minutes, and there's a tiny, random little cafe selling some dodgy pastries and coffees just down to my left.
I would say that we are awfully jealous of your location in the blue sky behind you, but anybody who's been following you on Twitter or Instagram over the last little while realises that this has been a bit of a slog, to say the least. From our perspective, how tough has it been for you?
Do you know what? I'm having the time of my life out here. I'm not going to complain too much or say it's too tough, because it's just turning into be the experience of a lifetime. Like, obviously, look, we're cycling big enough distances every day, and we have a lot of gear to carry with us. So obviously it takes a physical toll, but like, when you're wandering around Europe by bike, going through all these places that no one ever goes through, and just meeting all these random people who are doing really nice things for you every day, it's very hard to complain too much or feel too sorry for yourself, especially when I hear the weather's a bit dodgy back home. So I really can't complain.
To what extent did you have a plan to get from Achill to Athens, and to what extent have you stuck to it, and to what extent have you gone off the beaten path?
So we had a rough idea. Like, we had a kind of 6,000 kilometre path from Achill to Athens, kind of hugging the French coastline and going through northern Italy and Slovenia and Austria and down through Croatia and Albania. So we have a rough path. Now, we do kind of detour as we go along. When you have 58 days to get somewhere, if you want to stop and take a bit of a detour, you can. And inevitably, Google Maps has screwed us on occasion, and we've ended up down the craziest little dirt paths in the middle of forests, in the middle of nowhere with no phone coverage, completely lost. Like, you just don't know what every day is going to bring, and every day brings something completely random and unusual and borderline hairy moment that you just have to kind of figure out and get through.
What was the hairiest moment so far?
We had a hairy enough moment in Venice. Like, we were doing this, we either camp out or we stay in like the scaldiest hostel we can find. So we were staying in Venice in a place for like 12 quid a night, and there was no reception, no one at the door. We're knocking on the door, no one answers. Eventually we ring this number, some bloke comes along after 20 minutes. Oh, sorry, I wasn't here. Only ones in the place, it looks like some fella's just random living room that we're sleeping in. There's ants, there's bugs in the bed, there's just a rotten smell, hair in the bathroom. Don't see anyone for the whole evening, no one at reception. About 2 a.m, it's just this crazy banging on the door. We are like, right, do we let this person in? He's saying he has to stay here. No one at reception. We let him in, and then we're like, here, we can't let you into your room. We don't know how to get into the room. So we ended up like raiding your man's desk, finding keys for room number 4, giving that poor old fella a key, and he just wandered in and went to sleep. Like, just bizarre things like that happened, and like, we didn't know who was outside the door. We didn't know whether we were letting some sort of murderer on the loose into us. But yeah, it's just the most random set of events that you could possibly imagine.
For people who've seen it, you've obviously packed up everything. You're carrying a load of gear as well as yourselves throughout Europe at the moment. What's that been like, for example, going through the Alps and doing those massive climbs? I think was it last weekend or maybe midweek this week that you were going through those big climbs?
Yeah, we've crossed over the Alps twice. So we went from cross over the French Alps and then the Austrian Alps. And I suppose that in essence is the hard part about this. Like, if you take a standard road bike or a racing bike, it's about 7 kilos. We're on gravel bikes, which are a bit more durable and can take a bit more punishment. They weigh about 11 kilos. And then on top of that, we're carrying about 15 to 20 kilos of gear each. And then we're climbing 18, 19, 2,000 meters in a day up the Alps, 16, 17% gradients. That's the challenge, is the weight we're carrying. It's not necessarily the distance. It's the self-supported aspect. It's being tired and getting in somewhere in the evening, having to set up your camp, having to find food, having to eat breakfast on the side of a road, like, with just the most random kind of bits you can find. Like, we had like jam and tuna sandwiches one morning because there was literally nothing else to eat. Like, it's just, it's not for the faint hearted, and it's far from glamorous, I can tell you that much.
Jam and tuna, any good?
No, disgusting. Okay. Don't try it.
Keep that in mind. How does climbing the Alps compare to climbing Howth Hill, which I assume was your local training ground?
Yeah, same training ground as you own. I know you're kind of going up hill by bike. So no, there's just, it's on a different scale. Like, there's no climbing or no hills at home that can even compare to what we've done. It just doesn't exist at home. It's not on the same scale. Even if you go down to the Kingdom or down to West Cork or down to Galway or Mayo, it's just not there. Now, the only thing about the hills, they are painful and you do feel the lactic building up in the legs, but like, the scenery is just, it's just incredible and it's stunning. And do you know what, there's a nice feeling kind of knowing you're getting yourself up them and getting yourself, there's something cool knowing that you're getting yourself across Europe purely with your leg power. So look, I'm very hesitant to complain in any way about the trip we're on.
Can you talk to us a little bit about why you're doing this, Cormac?
Yeah, so I suppose like a short segment like this probably wouldn't do it quite justice, but I would have suffered quite badly with an eating disorder for many, many years, and I kind of hid it for 7-8 years and never really told anyone because of I was a male, obviously, and I was convinced that there was kind of something wrong with me, and I didn't think this sort of thing happened to males. And I suppose I only really got help for it this summer when kind of I was backed into a corner and had no other choice because my life was just kind of falling apart. So I'm just really trying to get the message out there that like there's a massive lack of eating disorder services in Ireland for men and women, like, and that the public system just isn't capable of handling what people need. And I suppose really the other message I'm trying to get across is that I know 100% there's males out there struggling with eating disorders who just aren't coming forward because they think they're the only ones in the world and the isolation is killing them, and that they think this isn't a male problem, but it very much is. And I suffered with it for 8 or 9 years. So we're really just trying to get that message out there that there is help there and there is a way back from it. And if you get the help that you can get, like I did, and I was lucky enough to get, you know, you can keep moving on with life and live quite a fulfilling life, even with the kind of challenges you have to overcome.
Cormac, you've been on the show with us in the past. You've been on telling your story, part of your story, when it came to the heart condition that you were diagnosed with at the age of 18. I think that's 10 years ago this year. How long does it take to recover from something like that and decide that taking on an extraordinary physical endeavour, like cycling 6,000 kilometres over the course of a couple of months, is something that you can actually do, and the mental challenges behind that?
Yeah, I suppose like when I was hurling with Dublin at minor and 21 level, I ended up getting the pacemaker. And do you know what? It probably just opened my eyes a bit, really. Like I would have been hurling obsessed growing up. It was all I knew. And it probably kind of just made me realise that elite level sport doesn't have to be the be all and end all, and that there's different ways of kind of bringing fulfilment into your life. And I suppose the kind of charity cycling aspect was probably something that kind of just I accidentally fell into. And like, look, it is a physical challenge, but it's probably nearly as much a mental challenge as anything like this sort of thing. Like, you can't think about the end point, or you can't think about Athens because it's so far away. You literally just kind of have to break it down and take it step by step. And there's probably some sort of a metaphor in there for anyone going through any sort of struggles or the type of struggles that I've been through over the last 7, 8, 9 years. There is no quick fix, and you just have to keep plugging away and try taking it day by day. And look, it's I wouldn't change the pacemaker on what happened. It keeps me fit, it keeps me healthy, and I'm able to do a lot more things now with it than I ever would have been able to do without it. So look, I'm not going to say I haven't had my struggles over the past 7, 8 years, but they all shape and form who you become and what type of person you end up becoming. And after the summer that I've went through with the intensive therapy for 2 months, for the first time in a long time, I actually kind of like who I am now. And I'm just going to keep plugging away and not try and worry too much about what's happened in the past.
Yeah, that's a powerful position to be in itself. Will you talk to us just a little bit about that accommodation that you make for, like, you just brushed over there, look, elite level sport, I had to make an accommodation for that, it's not for me, and then you obviously go down a different path. Was that an easy thing for you to do? Because, like, obviously, as you say, a lot of kids growing up, they just want to play for Dublin, they just want to, you know, play at an elite level, but that's like a 0.001% thing. So just talk to us a little bit, if you can, about that accommodation that you make when you reach those heights and then sort of have to make an accommodation for that not being the future for you.
Well, I suppose it was probably taken out of my hands in a way, Adrian. Like, I'm very honest about the fact that when I was playing minor in golf for Dublin, I didn't particularly enjoy it, but I had enough kind of cop on at 18 to realise that I wasn't quick enough to make it outfield, and that playing in goal was my only way that I was ever going to get to play senior hurling for Dublin. And I suppose after the pacemaker, it was such a knock for me mentally at the time. And to be honest, I was never the same player when I came back after the pacemaker. My confidence had drained. I like to play, as we all know, like, to play in goal, you have to have a kind of an insane sense of self-belief and confidence. And when I came back after the pacemaker, that was gone. So to be honest, it was taken out of my hands, because when I came back, I simply wasn't good enough on a mental capacity to play in goal for the Dublin senior hurlers. Yeah, I played Dublin under 21 after that, but it wasn't really that I had to make too much of an accommodation for it. It was more so that, like, do you know what? This pacemaker has probably left its mark on me mentally more than physically, and I probably don't have the mental capacity to survive at the elite level. So I suppose I probably pivoted a bit and said, right, what other sort of thing here can give me that kind of sense of fulfillment and joy in my life.
Yeah, cycling across Europe is gonna tick the box, isn't it?
How important has it been for you then, just to finish up, over the last couple of weeks, having two lads by your side? I know it's your cousin and one of your mates who's out there with you. You talk about the mental challenge that it provides. Having two lads out there going through the exact same thing as you, I presume, doesn't hurt one bit.
Oh, no, it's amazing. Like, Stephen is my first cousin and we've been best friends since we were 5 or 6. And Niall, I've played football with since I was 5 or 6. And we've been in school together. And the three of us cycled around Ireland together in 2013. And they're like... Having people by your side who are suffering with you when it's piss and rain, and it's a terrible thing to say, but we've all had, like, Stephen had a really bad day on Monday and Noel had a really bad day on Tuesday and I had a really bad day on Wednesday, and you don't want to see the other two suffering, but it kind of makes that your own bad day that bit easier to know, hang on, it's normal here at day 30 that I'm having a bit of a bad moment because the other pair have had it as well. It's just... like, we're living in each other's pockets, and I'm not saying we don't get cranky with each other occasionally, of course we do, but like, having the two of them here with me by my side is just such a massive support, and the three of us are pretty close knit and we're pretty tight, so we're getting each other through it.
Do you have a date set in mind for your arrival in Athens, or is it kind of taking as it comes?
October 28th is the date for Athens, so everyone is... there's a few people flying over to us, flying over Aer Lingus rather than Ryanair, because we know Ryanair have a few issues sometimes on. We have a few people coming over to us. So hopefully October 28th, all going to plan, we'll get there.
And idonate.ie/Ackle to Athens, is that the best place to donate?
Yeah, that's it. Or if you just Google Ackle to Athens, it comes straight up. So whatever's easiest.
Brilliant. And it's all in aid of BodyWise and for Pieta as well. Cormac Ryan, very best of luck with the final stretch. I'm sure it's going to be an absolute joy. Enjoy the rest of the Danube, and we'll chat to you soon, no doubt.
Cheers, lads. Take care. Mind yourselves.
Thanks a lot, Cormac Ryan there on the line. Best of luck to him with that. Some comments coming into us about our chat earlier on. Will says 90% of people are bandwagoners. If results turn, nearly everybody will come on board. Tig, people seem to forget that as well as a change of style, we also have a lot of new young players in the squad. One campaign isn't enough time to judge the group. Why can't people see, says Gannonball, why can't people see that we're not good enough? Let all the haters name someone you think could do a better job. There's no one that could get results of this squad. We just need to give them time. And there's a fair bit of commentary around that. And also a lot of questions about the crappy quiz on Peter and Rubik's Cube, both wondering what the crack is.
We bring it back next week.
Owen just got a bit... he got sideswiped, even, as we're all aware, with international travel this week. And it's just set him off...
So I have done a full week's work and I just didn't do one.
And you're still not right, I know. It's
clearly just laziness rather than anything else.
Righto, it is 8:08. It's Friday morning, you're watching OTB AM. Lots still to come. Packed show en route. We're going to hear from Hector Hook on in just a little bit. We're going to talk rugby with Alan Quinlan. Up next, football with Quavo O'Neill. OTB
AM. Obviously the concession of the goal against Azerbaijan, obviously... it's got a goal from distance. Two goals we can see at home have been, you know, some goals from distance. So we have to make sure that doesn't happen again. And, you know, convert our chances, create an awful lot of chance against Azerbaijan. And we just obviously, on the plus side, we've shown a capacity in the last couple of games to equalise late. And we haven't had that, you know. So it's important that we had that. I think the formulation of the team and in the summer... you know, you can see the sort of connection out between the younger players, the more experienced players, and the team spirit is good, as we showed against Serbia. Serbia were very good against us, but we, you know, we played a lot of good football in that match and got the late goal against Azerbaijan. So the ability to keep going, that level of persistence and perseverance and the capacity to score late goals, that's an important trait. And we've seen that in countries such as Wales, for example, who have had scored a lot of late goals over the last few years. And we've noted that, like, in game, very, very tight games, they've scored goals late. And it's an important characteristic of any team who wants to be successful. And so it was good that in the last window that we did that. And we just need to... because we have taken the lead in games against Portugal and Serbia this year in qualifiers. So it is important. The ability to get late goals is an important trait. And one that we hadn't shown up into the last window. So it was important now to get them two late goals that we need to continue in that vein.
Now it is, we're going to continue with our theme of football. Delighted to say football writer with The Athletic, Quavo O'Neill, joins us. Morning, Quavo.
Good morning.
Liverpool City, obviously, the really the only thing we want to talk to you about this morning. It's live and off the ball. Nathan and Kenny, Muttley and Jeff going to take it away from 4:30 on Sunday coming. Just looking at the build-up to it, Cuiva, so Brentford and Porto for City feels like, for Liverpool I should say, feels like a better run than Chelsea PSG. So is it advantage Liverpool before we even begin here?
I mean, I don't know, considering Brentford gave Liverpool a good run for the money, didn't they, at the weekend. I think they really tested Liverpool in a way no team really have this season, or and they got to them a little bit. Liverpool looked a little bit scruffy around the edges, I guess, on Saturday night. They recovered from that, obviously, against Porto, which is, you know, a place Liverpool have enjoyed going, as we know, over the past few seasons. And, you know, to score 5 goals with ease, Curtis Jones, outstanding man of the match performance, Mo Salah, what more can we say? He's scored in 8 consecutive games now. He's just on a ridiculous run of form. He's, you know, I've been saying since the Norwich game at the start of the season, he looks different than he's ever looked. He's just got this extra edge, and I feel like this, he could go on and surpass his own goal record. I mean, he's already beaten his own record at the minute. I think, you know, he keeps just, yeah, amazing us all. So Liverpool have got a real leader in him. Obviously Van Dijk's back, which has been, you know, massive for Liverpool, massive for Alisson, massive for the back line. Obviously Trent Alexander-Arnold won't be playing on Sunday after he picked up a muscle injury. James Milner will fall into that role, age 35, and just playing wherever Klopp needs him, you know, sets the tone, I think, for this Liverpool team. But yeah, I think a perfect midweek for them, and probably a perfect weekend in a way, because they know that, you know, they can't just rest on the laurels here against any side, let alone a newly promoted team. So, you know, I think that will give them the hunger that they need, in the same way, you know, City beating Chelsea will give them that, and also getting beat by PSG in midweek as well.
You mentioned Mo Salah there. Why is he different this season? Why is he even better than his amazing best that we've seen over the last couple of seasons?
I don't know what to really say. He looks different. He's not particularly, I don't know if he's doing anything different in terms of diet or fitness. You know, he's got an incredible fitness record anyway. As we know, he rarely misses games. He just looks like all of the years before, but just something, like a special little spark to him. You know, when he picks up the ball, you feel like something magic's going to happen. I don't know whether maybe it's because fans are back in stadiums and he is a real performer. Maybe it's something to do with that, perhaps. And, you know, there's no better place to do that at Anfield on Sunday, when obviously Manchester City beat Liverpool there last season with no fans in the ground. You know, fans are back in the ground, so Liverpool want to start up that record which they lost last season of, you know, being unbeaten against Man City at Anfield for such a long time. You know, Pep struggled, his teams have struggled there, Man City teams have struggled there in the past. Obviously last season they didn't, they ran riot in the end. But, you know, I think coming back to Salah, he looks different in a really, really good way. And it's quite scary probably for the rest of the league that, you know, other forwards are maybe scoring and dropping off. He just looks like he's going to score in every single game.
Yeah, it's a powerful tool to have. Karen Carney, an interesting piece in The Guardian during the week, Cuiva, she was talking about that City relentless press, particularly against the top teams. And that was sort of the context maybe to the question I asked at the top in relation to Chelsea and PSG, particularly that relentless press against them over that period of time. Like, it's the sort of thing that could potentially, with that number of games against that level of team over that short period of time, potentially over the last 20 minutes, could really play into Liverpool's hands.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these games against Man City and Liverpool, you always feel like they're almost won in the first 15 minutes. Whoever sets the tone and runs out the best and presses the best. And I do think we're coming into probably the time when these teams are actually having seen a bit of City against PSG and Chelsea, and Liverpool against Brentford and Porto. I feel like these teams are pressing as good as they have done in seasons before. They look back to the best in terms of, you know, you know, hunting in packs all over the pitch. So I feel like we're coming into a perfect weekend for that to be on display. And I guess it's head-to-head who's going to be the winner. And you do feel like in the present stakes, that'll be one of the big sort of key things to look for. I do think it does take a little bit out the legs, doesn't it? And I guess, you know, both teams have had away trips in the week. So I guess, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how much energy they've got. But I do feel like it's definitely the first half, who can get out the blocks quicker. And then obviously, you know, as the game goes on, who's going to tire first and who's going to give up the press a little bit. So I think it's going to be a really interesting game. One of maybe the best between Man City and Liverpool. Now I've said that, it's probably going to be 0-0. So I'll shoot up.
I don't think... the 1-1 last year at the Etihad was a classic from memory, but it's a game that's been brought up quite a bit this week because in that fixture Jurgen Klopp did go with his four attackers. He started on the day with his four attackers on the pitch at once. There does seem to be some thought after Firmino's brace the other night that possibly Klopp could do the same thing this Sunday. What do you reckon yourself?
Yeah, I've got a feeling Firmino might just nip in ahead of Jota, just right, because Jota's performance in the week didn't, you know, he really needed a goal to sort of cap off what was not his best game, even though Liverpool were relentless. You know, he was really good, but he just wasn't, you know, to the level maybe we've seen from him in previous games. I mean, his header against Brentford was phenomenal. You know, he only looks little, but to get up the way he did to meet Jordan Henderson's cross was just superb. So he's definitely got goals in him. Whether Klopp might not want to put all of his attackers on the pitch, I'm not entirely sure what he's going to go with. As you said, he did it last season, obviously didn't quite work out for Liverpool. So whether he, you know, is a bit more reserved and goes back to that, you know, relying front three of years before. You know, Firmino looks to be coming into a good little run of form. Obviously had that injury which kind of disrupted it a little bit. But, you know, he's been such an integral and important player for Liverpool, and he really does love games against Manchester City. So you'd expect him to, you know, put in a good performance. But again, it would not surprise me to see him left out at all, and Jota to start ahead of him. But, I think I've just got a feeling for Firmino at the minute.
Yeah, the more experienced player maybe is wins the day on it. You mentioned the Brentford game earlier on, the 3-3. Klopp was saying afterwards that Liverpool had played brilliant football but struggle against Brentford's long balls. Like, that could have been, as can be the case with managers after games, a bit of a dig, obviously, at the opposition. Or it could be a bit of an insight, and like, it would nearly feel like an insult to a team like Manchester City to suggest that going long is any plan, never mind about a plan A. But is that the sort of credible way for a team, even like City, to get at this Liverpool side?
I think so. And I do think that last season, you know, when Liverpool had that run of six defeats on the bounce at Anfield, and, you know, January to March was just dismal, really. Obviously, they'd lost so many defenders, all of the defenders, but and midfielders were playing in defence. But I don't think that was... I think then the high line Liverpool hold sort of struggled a bit more and was exposed more. Obviously, with Van Dijk back, sort of being the leader and dictating the line, and Alisson in there as well, looking back to his best. I do feel like still, you know, it's something that can be got out if teams do it right, but it's just worked so well for Liverpool. You know, with risk comes the greatest reward. And I do think Liverpool themselves have some, you know, Van Dijk in particular, will hit the odd long ball over the top or a diagonal and get Liverpool in behind Jordan Henderson. We've seen Fabinho do it as well, you know. So it's not just other teams that can do it. Liverpool can do this as well. But I do think that's a way Man City will potentially try and get at Liverpool on the break, perhaps. But I do think, you know, this is one that's going to be won in the pressing game rather than balls over the top. But yeah, I think it's something that Liverpool have been caught out at in the past, but we'll see what City can produce on Sunday.
And what happens with that? Trent Alexander-Arnold looks as is out. Grealish and João Cancelo seems to be a thing that's developing nicely for City, particularly down that left-hand side. How do you see that dynamic panning out in his absence?
Yeah, I mean, well, James Milner will be there, only, and he'll be keen after, I think, you know, his performance against Crystal Palace at full-back was brilliant. And obviously he held off Wilfred Zaha, who's one of the trickiest players in the league. So he'll have the same, you know, similar job to do with Jack Grealish, who's looked pretty good since he joined Manchester City. Looks like it's taken his game up to another level. João Cancelo as well, we know his qualities. He can play all over the pitch. And I think, you know, there might be times when Milner playing there might be a good thing defensively. He's just sometimes got that little bit of extra now. He's great at winning fouls. Milner, I don't think he gets enough credit for that, you know, breaking the game up a little bit. I think, you know, Liverpool fans will be hoping he can do a job with his experience and, you know, sort of keep Jack Grealish quiet. I guess we'll have to see what happens there because we know what an incredibly gifted player he is. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the game goes. And I do think that's one of the sort of talking points going into the weekend, obviously with Alexander-Arnold missing with that muscle injury.
Yeah, you mentioned Curtis Jones a bit earlier on, and he's been rightly lauded, obviously, after the game during the week. He's in there, I think everybody accepts, because of injuries, obviously, to others. But there's a good chance that he cements his position now. How good can this guy be?
I mean, yeah, he'll be 21 in January. He's pretty ridiculous already. He's super talented player. We've seen that, you know, in the past couple of seasons. You know, is appearing to sort of dried up last season a little bit, haven't been for a long time, you know, Klopp's go-to man, which, you know, is incredible because I think then he would have been a teenager at the start of last season. You know, to think the amount of times Klopp has played him, he's now made over 50 appearances for Liverpool. I think he played really well at Brentford, obviously got his goal. I think the best thing about him is the danger he creates, the runs he makes. He's a proper attacker midfielder. He wants to score goals. He wants to create goals. And he will continue to do that. I feel like, you know, the world's his oyster almost. And, well, Liverpool is, because he's, you know, a boyhood fan. And he's very competitive. He wants to play as many minutes and as many games as he can for Liverpool. And you'd imagine he will go on to do that with performances like against Porto, where from the first minute, he dominated the game. He had a hand in all five goals. He was the go-to man for Liverpool, and you know you can see his talent on display. And I think, particularly on that left of midfield, that's I think his preferred position. You'll see him cutting in centrally as well when Liverpool aren't in possession, and then you know he'll make those darting runs. And also he's got a pass in his locker too. He tries quite a bit for Mohamed Salah at times just to sort of get him away on the wing. He can go very far. You know, he's already, maybe with these appearances, you know, making a little tiny little bit of noise in terms of should he have been called up to the England squad. I think it's probably a little bit early for that. Obviously, he plays with England's under-21 still. But, you know, he's a player with massive potential, massive quality. I spoke to those who know him a little bit, and you know they called it genius mentality, and said they've never seen a player quite like him in terms of his mentality is just that elite level. You don't see that in other young players of his age. Well, you do, but not all of them. You know, it's kind of, he's on the level of Harvey Elliott as well, who was unfortunately injured. And I think, you know, that bodes well for Liverpool to think Curtis Jones could one day be on the left of midfield, Harvey Elliott on the right. It feels like maybe the future of Liverpool's midfield is already shaping up.
It did seem maybe a couple of weeks ago that you think that Jones is thriving because he's playing alongside Fabinho and Henderson, certainly over the last couple of games. But actually, that's not necessarily the whole story at all, Caoimhe. It does seem that this guy could actually slot into almost any of the three midfield positions, such as the array of talent that he's shown so far. Like, do you see that in future, that he is the guy that Liverpool build the midfield around, and he can, I guess, slot between those three roles, those defined roles that Klopp likes to have in his midfield?
Yeah, definitely do. I think, you know, he hasn't really played as a defensive midfielder in that holding role. And, you know, Klopp just dropped him in as the number six against Norwich, and he performed really well, like he'd played there for years. So I think, you know, definitely that was a big moment for Jürgen Klopp, who was, you know, asked time and again for consistency from Curtis Jones. And he's starting to deliver that now with the past three starts that he's made. You know, he's stepping up. There have been injuries, so he's managed to, you know, work his way in there a little bit. But I do think, you know, to start the season, he was someone that could have potentially started, but obviously he suffered concussion against Norwich, and that just before the Norwich game, that meant he missed that opener, and that kind of put him back a little bit. But now we're seeing, you know, maybe that was a good thing for him. He needed that little bit more training, a little bit more hunger, He's an incredible midfielder. I think him on the left is definitely his preferred role, but it wouldn't surprise me to see him over on the right, because he does pop up sometimes there throughout games. He's, you know, someone who can play across the midfield and even further forward as well. You know, he's very talented, skillful, and really calm on the ball, and just sort of, he's got a swagger to him which, you know, he just kind of, when he's keeping the ball, you're not getting it off him. And I do kind of like that confidence that he's got. But, you know, still a long way to go in his Liverpool career. He's not satisfied with 50 appearances. He wants to make 500. So, you know, that'll be what he's aiming for. And, yeah, I think he'll definitely be starting, you'd imagine, based on his last three performances. So, yeah, I think he'd be in the midfield against Manchester City.
There's been at least one big European night at Anfield. There's been good games, and Chelsea have been there. It feels like we're sort of getting back to the point where we might be taking all this for granted again. But City at Anfield is going to be a big one, and I'm assuming that everybody is still slightly in that mindset of, geez, isn't it still great to be back at games? So all should lend itself to a monster atmosphere on Sunday.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, for Liverpool to have fans back is massive for them. It's massive for all teams. But I do think Liverpool in particular really, really struggled at Anfield. You know, unbeaten there for 4 years, was it? And then, you know, everyone turned up and started beating Liverpool there, Everton, Fulham, whoever it was. You know, records just disintegrated. And I do think Liverpool fans being there, almost, you know, they can't have a say on the pitch, but they can get behind the players and almost have a say in that way, and almost like a conductor, you know, control the game a little bit through their support. And, you know, Man City over the last few seasons, particularly at Anfield, have been some of the best atmospheres Liverpool fans have created. So I think, you know, Sunday's just going to be ferocious from the minute go. You know, there'll be a big cheer to get behind the team, and, you know, they'll be singing songs all game, and hopefully, you know, Liverpool will keep putting in performances that will keep Liverpool fans singing throughout. But yeah, definitely it's going to be a raucous atmosphere, and we welcome it, because, you know, it was so long when we were just watching games without fans, and it even affects just watching on TV. You know, you can sort of sense that it just doesn't have that extra edge with fans in there. I do feel like it helps players perform to the best. Look at someone like Salah, he looks different this season. And I do think, you know, part of that is because he's a performer, and, you know, having fans back is integral to players like him. And just, it's nice to get back to the match, isn't it?
It's not going to be 0-0, is it? It's not going to be a drab 0-0.
I know, well, now we're bigging it up. I feel like it could be, but no, it's got one of those 4-3 kind of games written all over it, I think.
We take it. Cuiva, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Cuiva Neal of The Athletic. And as I said, that game is live and off the ball on Sunday, 4:30. We also have the Villa game. But on the Liverpool City match will be Nathan Murphy and Kenny Cunningham. So that is definitely one to look forward to for all of those reasons. And we'll have more on that, I'm sure, as well over the next 24, 48 hours. You are watching OTB AM. We're live, brought to you in association with Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with the new and improved razors. We have lots more still to come, and the comments still coming into us. People pretty delighted that the crappy quiz is coming back next week when Owen can get the finger out. And Mo having fun scoring makes watching him a delight, says Brandon on YouTube as well. It really is one of those things as a neutral that you can just get behind. Mo Salah in full flight on, it's a thing of beauty.
The thing with Mo Salah as well is that whenever you watch him, you feel that he could score a hat-trick every game. Even when he's killing the opposition and gets a goal or two, you're like, he could be getting three or four here every game. Not that he's like wasteful with his opportunities or anything. He tends to grind out a couple for himself every game. But it just feels that the volume of chances he's getting this season maybe is up a bit. Maybe that's why we're seeing a different Mo Salah. Actually, his teammates are just better. I always felt the moments of criticism of Salah over the last couple of years have always been off the mark. You can't expect a player to be scoring in every single game. And he did go through a couple of bad spells over the last couple of seasons, but if you look back on it, it's probably only two or three games in a row where at most maybe where he doesn't score. I just think he's an absolutely unbelievable player, and he will go down as one of the greats ever when it comes to the Premier League. And this season he's just started off incredibly well, incredibly well, and at the age of 29, still improving, it seems.
You don't want to get too far into the Virgil van Dijk being responsible for everything, right? But like, I think do think there is an element of that solidity at the back and the impact that it has further up the pitch. We spent a lot of time last season talking about why the loss of him had resulted in X, Y, and Z, and obviously there were pulling players from midfield back to cover centre half, and that probably had an impact as well. But I do think it shouldn't be underestimated the solidity that generally Liverpool have at the back, Brentford notwithstanding, is going to possibly impact on everything else that happens further up the pitch.
And like when they're on the front foot as well, having Van Dijk on the ball is an unbelievable weapon. Like, I think that there were a couple of admirable performances at centre back last season from Liverpool, but it was always on the defensive side of things. It was like Nat Phillips with a million headers in one game, whereas what Van Dijk really brings, and I think that he's still yet to get back to his best, obviously, on a consistent level, and that'll take some time, but I think the real difference from Van Dijk is just when he's on the ball, what he can offer, and how it makes the opposition think, where it's like, right, this guy's a live threat. When he's on the ball, he's going to be able to pick a pass. And it just transforms how they're attacking, having Van Dijk on the park. And eventually it will come to a stage where they're keeping clean sheet after clean sheet after clean sheet, because we have the majestic Van Dijk back in a defensive sense. I've got absolutely no doubt that we'll see that at some point this season.
Yeah, and potentially starting on Sunday as well. Right, thanks to Gillette. We're going to let you know about our competition. We're celebrating the return to normality with a very special prize. It's UEFA Champions League tickets to Chelsea against Malmo. It's on the 20th of October. We have a couple of these prizes to give away, by the way. So two lucky winners. We're going to have one finalist, our final finalist, chosen this afternoon to go into the hat with four others from the rest of the week, and then two of them are going to be chosen to head along for Chelsea Malmo, 20th of October, flights and accommodation included. So you can enter the competition via our Twitter page. We're going to be posting an image up there. We have already done so. In fact, a bearded sports person, it's appeared every day this week. Just respond to that post. Tell us who you believe that person is for the chance to win this amazing prize. And as I said, we've two of them to give away, and we will do that on our social later today. Put your hashtag best face forward with Gillette. Stay tuned to Off the Ball Social for more details on that. Time for the papers now. It's 8:32, and here's what's happening on otbsports.com this morning. Curtis Jones is the type of player Liverpool need, and that's very much the sentiment of Cuiva O'Neill just there a couple of moments ago. That was John Giles in conversation with Nathan last night. Also Michael Connellan's reflection on all the fallout from the Olympic Games. He's saying, give me back the give me that bronze medal. He's only gone for bronze. I thought he might have been a bit further up. Jack Conan as well in conversation with Nathan on Off the Ball last night. More of that up there on otbsports.com. From some of the newspapers, the Irish Independent, busy Irish Independent this morning. Stephen Kenny, new deal, not a worry, says Aidan Fitzmaurice here. Ireland boss insists that he's not fixated on the contract as he picks Wigan's Keane for Azerbaijan trip. Mayo legend Moran, as we've been discussing a bit earlier on, Conor McKeown, Moran set to take over the reins from Highland in Leitrim. Very interesting. An Olympic report vindicates my outburst in Rio, insists Conlon. That's the words of Sean McGoldrick inside there. That's the Irish Independent. The Irish Times, this leading with that Stephen Kenny press conference from yesterday, and indeed a photograph of Will Keane there. Kenny hopes to add keen edge to Irish attack, writes Gavin Comiskey. Solskjaer gets away with it again, but for how long, says Jonathan Wilson inside. The Mirror. Talk is cheap, says Paul O'Hare here. Kenny focusing on actions and results rather than discussions on his future. Phillips won't risk his Leeds love affair by signing for Reds. This is Calvin Phillips snubbing Manchester United and will sign a new Leeds deal with Marcelo Bielsa, claiming that he would never wreck his love affair with the fans. I mean, he probably would if they give him enough money. I think that'll all be good. Make it go away. Football focus. No contract concerns. Owen Couser here. Kenny not sweating over Ireland's future. That is the Irish Sun this morning. The Irish Daily Mail. We'll get to the back page here. There's Harry Kane on the back after his goal fest last night. Hat-trick. A half-hour hat-trick for hotshot Harry. Kenny hits back at McGrath, writes Philip Quinn inside. He doesn't really. And it's not really the tone of the piece. And it's not at all really what happened. He was very measured in responding to Paul McGrath, who feels that maybe Stephen Kenny is not the right man for the job. Football jabs crisis uncovered. Two-thirds of top players not double-jabbed. Clubs complaining that stars polluting dressing rooms with conspiracy theories. but unvaccinated players will still be available for matches. Special report inside. Lots more words in there. It's a topic that we touched on last Friday morning, and it's a topic that you imagine ain't going anywhere anytime soon. The Irish Daily Star this morning, El No, Calvin to snub United for Leeds, Kenny, I will show McGrath, and Frankie, true to his word. This is Frankie Dettori. Anybody who watched Friday Night Racing last week will have seen that he was riding in Bellystown yesterday, all in memory of Barney Curley. And Frankie drove home the winner there as well. The Telegraph, this is Harry Kane last night. King Kane, hat-trick hero there. RFU's transgender player rules face fresh scrutiny, report inside from Jeremy Wilson. And one last one from me, Owen, before we throw over to you. You've picked out one of the stories there. This is the Times of London this morning. Judges fixed Rio Olympic boxing bouts. I mean, Michael Connolly did tell us all. Number of years ago. Matt Lawton writes inside there, and a few other bits and pieces as well, including, we should mention here, from Martin Ziegler, fan jailed over online racism. A West Brom fan has been jailed for 8 weeks for racially abusing one of the club's players on Facebook. It's believed to be the first time that an immediate prison sentence has been imposed for online abuse of a footballer.
It's that story that you mentioned there from Matt Lawton that we want to pick up on, and it's covered by a lot of journalists over the past couple of days. It is this Richard McLaren report into boxing and corruption in boxing at Rio 2016. Obviously, it's something that we're pretty familiar with. I don't think anybody in Ireland was too shocked to hear the words corruption and I guess underhanded tactics being used in connection with the boxing events at Rio. So McLaren has found that there was a culture of favours, particularly amongst the post-Soviet countries. So there are two in particular, Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, that are coming under the microscope here. Azerbaijan gave AIIBA an investment loan of $10 million that bouts would be manipulated in their favour for medals at London 2012. So this is not just a report that has shown up how Rio was this singular disgraceful event in amateur boxing. London 2012 was essentially the groundwork for a lot of these organisations and these national governing bodies to try and get medals at Rio 2016. London has, with every passing month, it seems, lost every shred of integrity that it had as this great Olympic Games, this homecoming of British sport, this, I guess, bastion of hope for clean sport and for legitimate sport. Everything you read about that, those games now seems to cast a new shadow on it, and boxing is no different. So 2012 is when that $10 million investment loan from Azerbaijan goes in. I think the judges get a little bit spooked by this loan coming in, and they're like, it'll be a little bit too obvious if we give Azerbaijan all the decisions here. And I don't think Azerbaijan actually got as many medals as they wanted, and as a result they got screwed over a little bit. So poor Azerbaijan here tried to bribe, and bribed badly. 4 years later, a $250,000 bribe was also offered by Mongolian officials in an attempt to fix an Olympic semi-final. Now, we've also got from Professor McLaren here details on how these things happened, how the judges managed to communicate with each other, and how these fights were actually effectively fixed. He said the signalling process started off as something basic, using either agreed upon hand or eye signals between them, or leaning back or forward with their bodies to inform others of the way they should judge about. So, like, I'm not sure if they're like, lean back extremely far there in your seat if you think Michael Conlon is in trouble here, and we should definitely award this fight to Nikitin. He said that the corruption went right to the top. Shock horror. Who would have thought it? AIIBA, a poisonous, corrupt organisation back in the day. Wu Qingqiu and Karim Bouzidi are two of the officials named. Bouzidi, the then AIIBA executive director, Wu Qingqiu, the then AIIBA president, respectively being key actors in allowing the manipulation to flourish. Now, Bouzidi, according to Ingle here, was the chief architect of a scheme, with McLaren saying he seized powers to oversee the appointment of referees and judges that knew what was going on but would comply with the manipulation or who were incompetent. So basically they're looking around saying, can we find somebody who's weak, or can we find somebody who is open to being bent with regards to the corruption that we want to see unfold here. And there's one really interesting anecdote here. He says, in one case, McLaren says, a senior judge entered the room of an honest official late at night using a set of room keys obtained from the front desk. That official was then warned that as a result of the way the bouts were being scored, it wouldn't bode well for the witness's future. the witness recalled, I was scared shitless because I've got people coming into my room, like bursting into my room and telling me what I'm doing wrong. This is a pretty terrifying prospect if you are an innocent bystander in all of this and you want to referee or judge a boxing bout, honestly, at Rio 2016. Mm-hmm. It turns out if you wanted to do that, that was not the activity for you. Honestly, was not the MO of people involved in Rio 2016 boxing, but it goes beyond that. It goes back to London 2012 as well, and obviously Michael Conlon was on the record yesterday saying, no surprise whatsoever, I said it at the time, and a huge day for amateur boxing, he says.
When a boxer stands in the ring, outside the ring after a fight that clearly the result was not the actual outcome of, and says these guys are corrupt, it takes 5 years, is it? Am I calculating that correctly? 5 years to come to this conclusion. That, to me, I know you got to do due diligence, you got to look at it, you got to flip it this way and that. You know, and somebody's made a fair whack of cash also, by the way. Let's not forget that with, like, investigating this thing and getting to, I mean, the bottom of it. I don't know, maybe the middle of it somewhere. But I just can't really... the investigation begins straight away. It's so bloody obvious. You find out this stuff 4 years ago. You know, it feels like a bit the horse is bolting. I know that, like, boxing's under threat as well. It's been reported in some of the papers over the last little while that if AIBA don't get their act together, I mean, I don't know what the hell that looks like, that they're going to just be... I was going to use a word there. They're just going to be thrown out of the Olympics altogether. Now, that'll be desperate, obviously, for us particularly, and for the boxers that we have. But maybe that's what boxing needs.
Do you ever wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night and think to yourself, God, why couldn't Ireland just be good at something that was a little more honest? Why couldn't we just have a nation of brilliant kayakers where it's up to you, where if you screw up, it's on you. There's no dodgy judging or anything like that. Why do we need to be good at amateur boxing?
What we need to do, Owen, is to build... That's a really good idea. If we built like a white water centre in the middle of Dublin.
Maybe that was...
Excellent idea.
That's that was all above board. And something that people wanted. Like, if we could just shoehorn off our amateur boxers into something that would actually give them a fair crack at a whip, then coming up to the Grand Canal.
Is this the end of the... Have they put a full stop on it? Is a little ribbon on it now and it's been presented and there is no more to come?
I presume there will be implications for the report by Professor Richard McLaren, who is... who's done brilliant work, obviously. He exposed, essentially, the state-sponsored doping program.
I don't want to be overly critical. The outcome is sort of what you want. You just would like it. It's kind of an irrelevance now in that, like, all the protagonists have moved on. They've gone on to become professionals. They've retired, whatever. It's rear-view mirror stuff. Would have been good to have seen it 3 or 6 months afterwards.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, it's 8:43. You're watching OTBM, and we're delighted to have you along with us. The brand new Brian O'Driscoll podcast series, by the way, now available exclusively first on the OTB Sports app. In episode one, filmed this week, Brian talks about who's going to be Ireland's number 10 during the November internationals, how the Irish provinces might fare this season, and why the women's team are struggling right now. You can hear it first by downloading the OTB Sports app and subscribing to the Brian O'Driscoll on OTB channel. That's the one you'll need. And here is Brian on Munster's need for silverware this season.
Yeah, I do feel as though this is a really important season for that coaching ticket. You know, they're 3 years together now. They have improved in the first two, but the expectation from them, from as a squad and certainly as their supporter base, is to deliver silverware this year. And there's been a lot of talk from Johan van Graan, you know, being asked in the media about being in the final year of his contract, same with Stephen Larkin, they're all interested in staying. It'd be interesting to see what comes of that in the coming weeks and months. You know, if I was the Munster CEO, I'd probably be holding off until, you know, December, January, before I pull the trigger on what happened, because you want to understand whether there's been an improvement again, another pre-season together, and have they shown the level of improvement that is expected of a team of the quality that they now are showing. Their strength of squad is really good. I think, you know, you look at that back three, who are you going to leave out when you're playing with a full deck, with the likes of Sebo coming back, Shane Daly, you know, really another year of professional rugby under his belt, with great talent. You know, Haley, Mr. Solid, Conway Earls, these guys, it's very, very exciting from their perspective. But one thing being exciting, you've got to then deliver. And I do feel as though nothing short of some form of silverware this year will be acceptable from a Munster perspective, because they've taken the stepping stones of being a very disappointing team 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago, to really improving quality of squad, excellent strength and depth, good foreign signings, really good. Orji Snyman hopefully fit for the season this year, and the emergence of Ahern, of Coombs, of Casey, of a couple of the tens that are, you know, going to now get game time and back up to Carberry, with AJ Hanrahan gone to France. So all of these things are culminating towards giving them a great shot at being in the mix in two competitions. So I'm intrigued to see how they progress over the course of the season, and what decision comes of the futures of the coaching staff.
That is Brian O'Driscoll in conversation with Ger during the week. As I mentioned, you can get Brian O'Driscoll on OTB First every week on the OTB Sports app. Download it now in your App Store, and it is free. So that's the place to go for that. By the way, if you're watching OTB AM live this morning on YouTube, welcome along. Delighted to have you wherever you are. YouTube tends to be the place that most people jump on to drop their comments in. Oh, and engagement is huge, I think, is what the Gen Z would say about our YouTube channel. We are Ireland's home of debate. We've got analysis, breaking sports news and reaction as well, and live every morning, as you know by now, from 7:30. And if you are new, though, do subscribe. Or indeed, if you've been chugging along there for the last couple of years, just jumping in every morning, hit subscribe. It's much easier, because we'll hit you up then with the best stuff. We'll let you know when it's happening, and you can hit the notification bell as well. And if you're not new and you haven't subscribed, what are you waiting for? 123,000 people on, and others have hit subscribe, like, so much so they've given us this little lovely little sort of thingamabob here behind us. So hit subscribe on that thing. We appreciate all the support, and we appreciate support in the comments as well, and there's plenty of them coming into us this morning. They can be a bit sort of all over the place, really, our commenters. We've got Peter M here saying that Luxembourg international scoring the winner against Real for Sheriff tells you all you need to know about where they are at compared to Ireland. That was our conversation about Stephen Kenny a bit earlier on. Stephen Douglas, I don't know if it's slightly randomly or because Hector's coming on, wondering why don't Irish people on OTB speak on OTB Irish language?
Good point. We could definitely pivot. I wonder, would we get a thingamabob over your shoulder for getting to 100,000 Irish speakers?
Yeah. I mean, that would be predicated on... How's your Irish?
Oh, come on.
That's exactly what people who haven't got the two words to stick together, like myself.
I went to Irish college.
What does that mean? Did Greg Craig?
I spent my summers, like 2 weeks, learning Irish. So
this is the PR job for the English language here.
I'm desperate at Irish, unfortunately, and it's a shame. And I think everybody feels the same, right?
I'm desperate at Irish as well, and I haven't really cared less about it until very recently. Particularly, I was down in your neck of the woods, and we were in with a family who speak Irish. They also speak English, but it was Irish, and they had young kids, and I felt really bad that, like, there was 5-year-old milling around who was, all he wanted to do was chat away in Irish, and it was actually great because I could sort of chat to him and use my really poor Irish to I didn't feel judged.
I was going
to
say, like, so what age child would you be comfortable having a conversation with in Irish?
Well,
like,
not 5-year-old.
At what point do you start to get out of your depth?
It turns out I was totally out of my depth.
He or she actually ran rings around you conversationally.
He did, yeah, entirely. And now my own almost 5-year-old has started to come home from school with Irish words, and I've been wowing him with, like, he'd be like, "Oh, we learned the Irish for window today. What's that?" And I'd be like, "Oh, fwin yog." But, like, I'm about a month away from him making a fool out of me. That's what's happening there.
Cunis Boher, Colleen Bonney, I think you need to drop on him when he gets to age 6.
Alan O'Neill says that he hasn't watched the Olympics in a long time. Too much corruption. Paralympics a better watch. He says the Irish language was banned in schools until recently. We were forced to learn French, says Hot Rocks. I don't know where the hell you went to school.
It's our French. Have you not heard about the Norman invasion? We were all forced to learn French.
He also says you must be thick, 12 years at a subject and you don't know it. Like, I mean, I think I spent even longer than that. I don't know.
Commenter makes a very good point.
Is it us or is it the system? I mean, I just don't know. We're not sure. Right, 10 to 9. It's Friday morning. We still loads to come. Hector's going to join us in a little bit. His brand new show out in TG Carr last night, so we'll talk to him about that in just a few moments. Before all of that, good morning, Alan Quinlan.
Morning, lads. How are you?
How's your Irish?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that. It's brutal.
Well, I'm not able to ask you through Irish, so at least that's a saving grace for everybody.
Yeah, it is.
We've been really poor now. We've been talking a little bit over the last couple of weeks about Ireland's style. Paul O'Connell has been on having a conversation about it. Brian Driscoll has touched on it and others as well, about Ireland's style generally, where it's at, what it should be like, what sort of a system we should put in place. How would you describe to somebody who lands down from planet Jupiter about what Ireland's rugby style actually is?
It's a tricky one. I think if you go back to probably our style under Joe Schmidt, it was very much a possession-based game where we put massive emphasis on holding on to the ball, keeping it for long periods of time, and then kicking really accurately and putting pressure on the opposition. It was simple, it was incredibly effective, and it wore the opposition out. I was looking at some stuff last night about this, and I found an article from a couple of articles, John Barclay, the Scotland captain in 2018. He did some press before that fourth Six Nations game. Ireland started off beating France, Wales. Remember the famous Johnny Sexton one in Paris? They beat France, Wales, yeah. Italy. Set themselves up in a good position at Scotland in that fourth game. And we were starting to believe maybe that you would get 4 out of 4 and maybe head to Twickenham for a Grand Slam decider, Triple Crown, and all that on the line. And I was looking back at some of the stuff that John Barclay said, because, you know, sometimes it's hard to identify exactly how a team are playing and what their structure is. Lots of the modern teams will have your 1-3-3-1 scenario with your forwards in phase play, if that makes sense. So it's about when the game opens up a little bit, not off scrum or line-out, that you, what are you going to do with your forwards? What's your shape in attack? What's your structure when the game goes into multi-phase? And, you know, lots of teams will keep two loose forwards out on the edge, and then the other six forwards, they'll have them in two pods in around the middle, working that kind of channel straight up and down the field, being options to carry, to have little tip-ons, to go behind that forward pod, and just trying to resource the ball. So the game has changed so much in the last number of years that, you know, I remember a time when I started playing professional rugby that the quicker you got from a line-out or a scrum and you were sprinting across the field to a breakdown and you were the ball was coming back against you as you were sprinting over there, you know. So there was an old emphasis on the forwards recycle the ball, the backs just stood out there and looked for space. But, you know, the game has changed so much now and everybody's more skillful. Everybody is more technically better at the breakdown, you know. So there's anytime anybody carries a ball, there's a danger that if somebody's not in there, the old scenario of just the seven or maybe the six would poach the ball on you. Everybody's trying to poach the ball. So I think it's changed a lot off phase. So what would I say Ireland's style is? Well, look, we can play like South Africa, which is pressure, power, physicality, and keeping it pretty simple until you get options for loads of space and you put it through the hands and you score with your wingers. Some teams, look at Japan, it's just move the ball, move the ball, move the ball continuously. So Ireland's style has been a mixture of power and trying to be evasive and keep the ball alive. And sometimes we get caught between the two.
Yeah.
And that's probably been an issue in the last couple of years where we kick a lot, we've a lot of one-out runners, and then when we move the ball at times, it's probably not on. So there's been a bit of a kind of a confusion. If you want to create something that... My vision and idea for Irish teams would be, of course, you need the bit of grunt and the bit of doggedness and put the ball up the jersey and maul and keep it simple at times, particularly in wet, windy conditions throughout the winter. But I'd love to see more of an emphasis on How do we find space? How do we break down the opposition?
On that, Quinny, right? What, so much conversation over the last couple of years about the Irish football style, right, and the personality, and how much of that is predicated on the manager that's there, and if he leaves, are we going to continue that, and can we introduce that at an underage level and then seed it out to all the senior levels? If you were to get David Nusafour's gig in the morning and you were to go in there, is that something that's viable in a rugby context? Like everything you've just described there, is Ireland following the trends of what other nations are doing? So is it viable for us to introduce a personality of play for Irish rugby at underage levels and let that seed all the way through to senior representative rugby at provincial international level?
Yeah, look, I suppose before I answer that, under Joe Schmidt, it was incredibly effective. And it wasn't just doggedness and kick the ball and one out runners. It was lots of strike plays and ingenuity and the opposition, just no matter how good they were. And the results proved that were...
But the point on that, right, is that that was Joe Schmidt coming in and deciding here's what we're going
Correct,
to play,
yeah.
right?
Okay.
But what I'm saying is, structurally, underneath all of that, is there somebody deciding that Irish rugby's personality is going to be X? Like, is that a viable thing, or are we too... Is the game at the elite level too... Is it not possible to bring in a system like that because ultimately New Zealand are going to pivot to play slightly differently and we got to follow that, or South Africa, etc.?
Yeah, well, look, it's if I got the job next year, right, and I won't be applying for it and I won't be qualified enough for it, my vision and my thought process, and I always had this as a player, and it probably drove coaches demented who could coach me. At times, I was very kind of against the structure of playing four or five phases and then we can play what's in front of us. There's a certain amount of structure you need. You can't just go off a line out and say, well, the fly half will have a look and see what the opposition are doing and just spin it out to the wingers if we get enough time. There's times where you know you're going to punch up your 12, you're going to play a forward pod around the corner, you're going to try and exhaust the opposition and get them to move around a bit, maybe come back in field with another pot or two and then maybe try and go to the wings. You'll always have to have that kind of structure. But I always believed, and it's the way, you know, you hear the word philosophy and what your belief is in philosophy as a player or a coach. I always believed that, and sometimes I see the Irish provinces and I see maybe the Irish team, we play some of these kind of structured moves to build phases, and we play them as if we're just going through the motion. We're going through the system rather than trying to make a line break off the first phase. And I think it's sometimes, and maybe I'm wrong, I'm open to criticism here or correction, but it's kind of in my underage structure and my coaching all the way through, there was huge emphasis on scrum, line-out, breakdown, defence, physicality, and not enough emphasis on catch pass. Mm. Now, I'm not saying that we never did catch pass. Of course we did. And I probably saw a big difference when Tony McGahan took over as head coach in Munster. And even when he was doing skills and defence with us, we were doing lots of little rugby league plays and plays out in the backfield with certain backs where, you know, you'd hang behind the outside centre and he'd be chatting to you about doing little switches, little pivotal plays and stuff like that. But it wasn't natural to us as a group. So if I took the job and I was involved, I'd say what I'd love to see is right down to the grassroots structure is way more emphasis on catch pass skills and realignment. A lot of times I see it, even in the professional teams, I see the alignment after multi-phase gets flat, gets static. And I think, of course, there's high quality coaching going on in all the provinces and there's top quality players. And this isn't an issue, a major issue with the, you know, the catch pass stuff or the realignment, but at times we see it and you see some players who are just not naturally happy and with evasion. And of course they can pass, but under pressure, it's not just part of their mentality. You know, someone like Rua Tupoki, who I played with Munster when he came in, he changed the way we played. Lefemi Mafi, not necessarily Doug Howlett, because Doug was a winger and he was, of course, he was a finisher. But Mafi and Tupoki, I'm talking about that mentality where they want people around them to run with them, to attack, to be evasive, to have that ambition to run at the opposition. And that comes from New Zealand, where the kids there are always encouraged to pass, to catch, to run, to take on the opposition. And look, the game has dictated, the changes in the modern game have dictated a lot of robotic style rugby that we see. Every team system has a massive defensive coach or system which tries to break down the opposition. So, you know, off first phase, if you just run and think you're going to go through people all the time, it doesn't work, and you break down and you make mistakes. And international rugby, kind of the stats and facts show that if you play around with the ball and in your own half too much, you're going to get punished, turned over, make mistakes. The opposition are going to kick penalties. You lose the game. So it's a real catch-22 about style.
Well, but I think if you think about it this way, Quinny, right? If you come at it this way, looking at the four provinces, there are such contrast of styles of play, right? Particularly at the two that have been factually the most successful over the last number of years. There's a big contrast in what you would describe as, or what I would describe as, a philosophy of play there. So is it ultimately impossible to go to those provinces if you're the next David Nusafour and say, forget about everything that's gone before, we're now going to play this way? Is that just bunkum ultimately? Is that not doable?
No, I think with professional teams, you can't go in and tell them, well, we have to play this way. You have, like, the coaches decide what way they play, and sometimes it comes down to personnel. Every team is not going to have a Mafi and a Tupoki in their centres. You know, so it depends, and it has to be horses for courses. Weather dictates this. But what I would say is, I would love to see more of an emphasis at grassroots rugby of, and a lot of them are probably doing this anyway, but how do the coaches who are coaching kids throughout rugby in Ireland really put more emphasis on the skills, continuous work on skills, bring it into the warm-up, have kids doing it on their own in pairs of twos in their warm-ups and stuff like that, even after training, give them little exercise to do when they go home with the ball, all that kind of stuff. And it is probably done, so don't get me wrong. I'm not saying this isn't being done, but it's just, we always say it about New Zealand, don't we, in Australia. It's just continuous. We look at those teams and we think their skills are just unbelievable at times. And I think the Irish players can become more skillful and more comfortable in that role. There is no possible way that you can turn up in an international match and think you're going to run around the opposition. That doesn't happen. Even against, you know, we saw Georgia last year in the Nations Cup. You have to earn the right to go wide. But changing the mentality gradually in the All-Ireland League, in the representative teams. And I think Leinster probably, they're more recognised as an attacking force. And, you know, even when we played them in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was always, how do we stop the Leinster backline? Well, we stopped the supply, the source from the ball, because it was always the mentality of move the ball, move the ball. Traditionally, Munster were more dogged, more forceful. So that stuff doesn't have to change. But I mean, just changing the mentality and the skill sets of players. Even, you know, you see some of the games I saw last weekend for all the four provinces, you know, alignment skills stuff weren't 100%. And that's understandable. It's early season stuff, but it's just about changing that mentality. And what you do then, Adrian, is, again, it's a lot of this stuff is probably happening, but how do we coach the coaches in all the clubs around Ireland on Sunday morning, the grassroots stuff, to really, for them to understand the quality of the catch pass, the realignment, little switch plays, and getting young kids way more natural, like some people are just real natural footballers. Look at someone like Caelan Doris. He's a footballer. He's an evasive runner. He's an offloader. That he wasn't just coached into that. It's natural. So some guys are a bit more direct and probably don't have the same confidence. But I just think if we put more emphasis on that, so if I was coming in as director of rugby, I'd be saying, how do I get all the teams and people underneath me to really focus on more? I tell them my template, I want them to try and improve the skills and really, really focus on perfection around alignment, lines of running, catch passing. And then as you develop over the years, I listened to Paul about this, and we always chatted about, you know, line out and scrums and breakdown stuff. They're technical things that you can get better at. And usually you can kind of, if you understand lifting and line out and positioning and jump and all that stuff, it comes pretty quickly to guys who maybe not be line out experts or are really good in line outs. So you can improve that stuff very quickly. But the natural kind of ability to try and put a bit of evasion. And like, it's, I just want to reiterate this point. This is something that is happening. So it's not a case of, you know, throughout my career, we didn't work on catch passer skills. But I just think mentally we need to change the approach to try and really get brilliant at all that kind of stuff. And then that kind of gradually will improve the kids coming through. And hopefully then when they get to that level, the kind of natural one-out pass or flick or offload or stuff, they don't have to think about it. It's not out of their comfort zone. So maybe that will help. And the style of game we want to play, I would say, is, of course, loads of the, you know, the execution and the accuracy that Joe brought, and brought incredible success for five years. Championships, Grand Slams, you know, beating New Zealand twice. That stuff was phenomenal. And loads of brilliant tries with those strike plays. But just when the game opens up to 7 or 8, 10 phases, what are my forwards doing? How comfortable are they running? How comfortable are they being a scrum half, giving a 20-yard pass? All that kind of stuff, just trying to continuously improve the skill. So it does happen. And most of the top-level players can do that stuff. But there are certain guys who just look like they'd rather run hard with the ball. We've become a little bit robotic, not just in Ireland, in a lot of the modern day teams.
This seems like a conversation that we have at the end of every World Cup quarterfinal defeat that Ireland have, about how do we increase the playing pool, how do we increase the skill set, how do we tap into areas of Ireland that perhaps aren't traditionally rugby playing, how do you get the rugby ball into more people's hands at a younger age? And I guess that kind of is a contrast with this week, for example, if we talk about the women's game. And there's been a criticism of the IRFU's focus on the women's sevens program at senior level, at elite level. And I wonder if you flip that, Alan, and actually say, what about focusing on that at a more underage level, with more kids, in a more accessible game, essentially, than 15s? Could you essentially have more people picking up a rugby ball and, as a result, more skilled people who, if they want, end up playing full-on rugby union?
Yeah, possibly. I think all that stuff has to be funded on. And, you know, the RFU throughout the pandemic have probably let 25 to 30 people have lost their jobs. Going right back to when I played, and I've said this about my club, Clanwilliam, and rugby in the area, we would have had rugby development officers here when I was kind of coming up playing with Shannon and Munster. None coach me or poach me or brought me into the system. But after that, you know, we would have had different players, and there would have been a development officer in the club here in Tipperary Town who would have went around to certain schools coaching. And it was his job, essentially. He played rugby. Robbie Campbell, a New Zealander, playing with Clanwilliam. That's what he did. And you know, he found Tommy O'Donnell in a school in Care, who came then and played rugby in Clanwilliam. And of course, there's loads more kids who probably like rugby, still play GA and soccer, but there's an opportunity to get them into it. And I think, yeah, I think even encouraging kids to play sevens at a younger level, it's something that maybe would work. But there's development officers throughout the country. And this is something I didn't say on Monday morning about the women's game. There's still a lot of work to be done in the women's game, for sure. But there is development officers there. There is structures there. And the IRFU have spent money and supported this. Can they do more? Of course. Okay, so I don't want to get into a debate with somebody about that. But the men's game and the women's game, essentially, if you want kids to play sport and you want them to play rugby, who, when they haven't done it, they're not going to their local club, and you go into a school with a development officer, you want them to go out and have fun and enjoy it. There's probably a fear sometimes about the contact and the physicality for kids who are not used to that. But getting them having fun and improving their skills and getting them running with the ball and free-flowing is something that may encourage more kids to play. So going right down to the grassroots and improve... like I said, a lot of this stuff is happening, but the question is, how can we make it better? Like, we only have four provinces here, and of course the Irish team get lots of criticism and deserve to. They're well-resourced. You know, going to World Cups is disappointing. But, like, we haven't the biggest, let's be honest, if you're being honest about it, we don't have the biggest pool of players. We're always going to be under pressure to get to the level where we want to be in World Cup semi-finals or even going to a final or something like that, particularly after the high of 2018. So we continuously have to work on those resources. And the key is to that is obviously through the club game and, you know, trying to replicate maybe the school system, which is very difficult because they're essentially just mini academy after mini academy after mini academy and all the school system. And maybe that's where they get a little bit of a jump ahead of the other provinces. So
yeah.
More emphasis on the clubs, the rural clubs around Ireland. How do we improve? And they all these guys have been on coaching courses and they have their qualifications to coach the kids. Maybe it's an idea to get a load of ex-players and try and filter them around to a lot of these clubs and go in and take a session of coaching the coaches or give them a little bit of their expertise as a player where, you know, I could go in and do some lineouts and, you know, someone like, obviously Draco's gone around, you know, you couldn't get better to probably show guys lines of running and some of the skills of the catch pass and stuff. Mightn't be feasible, but just improve the coaching of these kids and hopefully then that it just becomes more natural to them when they become adults.
Yeah, has a knock on. All right, we didn't get a chance to talk about the rugby this week. We'll do that, I'm sure, on Monday as well. Quinny, thanks a million.
Cheers, lads. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Alan Quinlan, as always, on Friday's show. Okay, it is 12 minutes past nine. Lots still to come. We're going to talk to Hector Hookgun. He is up very shortly. Here's a sense of what's happening at OTB Sports Radio across the day. It'll be Ruby Walsh in conversation with Joe for OTB Goal at 1 o'clock. Friday Night Racing coming your way from three today. Tip against Kilkenny in that famous 2014 final as the Classic Game Club at four. And then an Irish football special in OTB Gold. That's Shea Given, Niall Quinn and Jason McAteer all in conversation with Kevin Kilban. That's from six today. And of course, Off the Ball live on the radio from seven. Right, up next this morning on OTB AM, Hector O'Hookagon is going to talk to us about his brand new show on TG Carr, Éireannua.
OTB AM.
All right, there's a brand new show that's been launched on TG Carr. First episode went live last night. It's called Éireannua. It's presented by an OTB AM regular, Hector O'Hookagon. He's going to join us in just a couple of moments' time. We'll give him the big sell again, and he'll be on the line to chat to us a little bit about that. I did watch it last night, I have to say, and really enjoyed it. But I mean, you know, I'm into the Irish language in a way that you're just not.
Oh, I watched a bit of it as well. I didn't see it all. I just fast forwarded to the bit with Kerry in it.
Well, listen.
Yeah, just I did that classic thing of, well, does my mother know that person? The sort of thing which you do quite often when something's on TV. I'm looking forward to watching the full series because it looks absolutely brilliant. What do you take from it?
I took from it that there isn't enough celebration of the diverse nature of Irish culture. Like, I think, particularly from a media point of view, there's a big responsibility to do more than just report on the bad stuff, which is, I think, what tends to happen, and not enough celebration of whether it's the varying nationalities that have come and settled in this country, or the people that have been here, like travellers, for example, for hundreds of thousands of years. And so, yeah, that's kind of what I take from it on, that I think it's a brilliant celebration. I think there should be more of this type of thing. It's a very positive story about where Ireland is at in 2021. So we've given it the big sell, and now the presenter of the show is actually on the line. So Hector, you can save us from filling time here. Good morning to you.
Did I hit the wrong button?
I think we're all hitting wrong buttons this morning. You're live, Hector. Good morning to you.
Sorry, apologies, boys. I hit the wrong button. Morning, Owen. Morning, Adrian.
How are you keeping?
Yeah, we're not too bad. Yeah, good. I just had the Weetabix, so we're sorted for Friday.
Good, man. The first thought I had when I watched Half Nine TG Carr last night and every Thursday for the next few weeks was, it's happy days for you, because in any other year you would have had a big conflict at around about nine, half nine on a Thursday night, but United going so well has suddenly freed up your Thursdays.
United going so well. I don't know about that. It was an amazing end to the game the other night, but we can't be doing that too often this season. Thursday nights, for the first time in years, we're doing a show now around Ireland. And as you were talking about, boys, last night was the first night of it. So I'm delighted with the reaction. And it was nice to get out during lockdown. We filmed for the whole of March, all the way through Cheltenham when some people were over in Cheltenham of March this year. I did about 28 days on the road. And we travelled to every county in the country. And there was a lot of sporting stories in the middle of all that as well. So hopefully it'll go down well. It shows where we are now with over 5 million people in the country for the first time since way back in the 18th century sometime.
Yeah. After 20 years, it was interesting watching your first link last night. I did wonder, after 20 years, are you still a bit apprehensive about how it gets received? Are you just like, listen, I got the magic formula here, this is going to be all good?
No, you never know. We're only as good as our last show, and we're all freelancers making this programme, and we just like making TV shows that hopefully people sit down, have a cup of tea and enjoy something different and keep it fresh. We don't come back three or four times a year with a show agent. We just try and do a show a year. It takes a lot of, there's about 10 people working on it. They're all freelancers, and I'm working with the same team of people. I mean, the DOP, Ross O'Callaghan, is the guy who shoots Hell Week. He's shot all the SAS Who Dares Wins. He's won BAFTAs for Grand Designs. He's won five IFTAs or four IFTAs on this travel show that we do for TG Carr. But we've a great team, and Evan Chamberlain, he's the guy I travel the world with as a producer. So it's a nice team of people when we try and make these shows. I know we've an arty audience. I know we've an audience that like what we do. So, and it's nice that it lives in the parish of TG Carr.
What was the biggest thing that you learned, Hector, from your travels?
Going abroad or around?
No, for this season.
Oh, it's just, I knew that they were there, and I knew that these people are walking the streets of the villages and towns of the countries, and not only in the cities. I knew that there was an amazing diversity, and it started, I suppose, let's go back to the Celtic Tiger. I know there were people coming to the country in a steady flow, but we never just noticed it. I suppose the Celtic Tiger opened our eyes to Polish, to the influx of Polish people who are prepared to get down and mix the cement and fill the sand and shovel in the wheelbarrows and do all the heavy work and then start plastering. And then work in the supermarkets or fill petrol or do all those jobs, or carpentry or first fixing and roofing. And we saw an amazing amount of Polish coming into the country. I still think there's well over 100,000 Polish still here. But so I knew they were there. I know they're in my local parish, and I know that the parish has changed. And I know the dynamic. If I'm coaching young lads under 17 and all the way through over the last few years, I could see in a few of the city teams that there was a few different cultures coming in, different coloured skins coming in, different lands were starting to play Gaelic football. And so, you'd see it. We could feel it. We could see it. But do we really know who these people are? I mean, are we taking our eyes out of our phone or in our busy, busy world as we walk along the streets or drive along a rural town? Are we looking to this to the paths to see who are the people? Have I engaged with them? Have I spoken to them? Do I know their background? Do I know what countries they come from? Do I know their language? Do I know their story? Because all these people have amazing stories, all completely different, of how they've got here and what they're looking for. And yes, they want a better life, but it's until you engage in that conversation. So for me, it was the richness of these stories was the best part of it.
It feels that the show comes at a really interesting time. There was one of your contributors towards the end, the lady in Donnycarney, I think she was talking about how she'd lived her, I don't know, was it 30 or 40 years, and it was only in the last 4 or 5 years she's felt that there's a racism that's come into Irish society. Like, it does come at an interesting time, Hector, where, and you just have to look at some of the pages this morning, reports that some lout in the UK has been given a prison sentence for abusing a footballer online. Like, it comes at an interesting time where I think people who feel it's okay to have those racist views now suddenly feel it's okay to publicly give voice to that.
Yeah, we're at a bit of a junction, aren't we? I suppose, I don't know. We saw what happened, across the water is a country that's broken in so many ways. I mean, booing national anthems and stuff like that coming from the stadiums and during the Euros from the English supporters. I suppose it's a lack of education. I think there's a lack of understanding I'm really positive about the future that I have a 17-year-old, 15-year-old boys in school. And that's a big school, and that these guys and that the new wave of young men and women coming through, and the new generation don't, hopefully the education and the openness to cultures and the openness to sitting beside your friend, new friends at school. And we're moving so fast in this country. I mean, that lady from Dunnacarney, Patricia, you know, when she arrived in and she went to that pub in Ballyferriter in 1977, as she said, she felt like an African queen walking into the pub, and everybody stopped. And the whole, the taps of the Guinness taps hissing. And it was only when they broke down the conversation by where are you working, and oh, you're going to be a nurse in Dublin. And then the conversation started, and they left. They had a great time in Ballyferriter on her first day ever in Ireland. But to think that she's dedicated 35 years of her life working in, there's a lovely photo of her working in the nurses in the hospital in Dublin. An amazing woman, but an interesting comment that she's only felt stuff like that in the last five years. Why has that happened? Is it technology? Is it the access of so-called proper information that we're getting on our mobiles? Is it because it's the done thing? Is it because these lads want to see the cool in a group mob environment, or if they're out on a couple of lads standing on the corner of the street? I don't know. You know, there's so many avenues and answers and questions of why that has happened and why it didn't happen.
And like the technology one is an interesting one, and I don't really, I've never really subscribed to the idea that it's the technology itself that's to blame other than the people that's behind it. But they're like, in our, the English comparison is obviously one that's very close at hand, and it's pretty grotesque at the minute in a lot of ways, in a way that we're not quite at and hopefully we'll never get. But there is like in my experience, I've been out and about, like a quiet, People feel comfortable, I feel, at times, as a white Irish person, expressing their racism to me as in a way that that they feel that I'm going to sort of suddenly support this idea that they have. It feels like, and I don't know if that's other people's experience or not, but that there is that, and it's not by any stretch of the imagination like a huge issue, but I definitely at times feel as if people are comfortable in their groups to express those views in a way that I wouldn't have seen before, I have to say.
Yeah, I could agree with you that. I don't know whether it's, again, it's the group environment or sitting having it's a casual comment. I know, but it is a very important topic, and we're at a very important stage of it. And throughout this series, we've met 35 different nationalities of people. But when you go down into the different shows, I mean, Boydu, we spoke to Boydu, say, yeah, we went down to Westmead, and I sat with Boydu in Rosemont outside Moulton. This lad has come over from Liberia as a 9-year-old and worked his way through school and picked up a size 5 football and then played for his club and then played senior and then has played for his county. And it was an absolutely lovely afternoon sitting with him in a beautiful sunny day in County Westmead. And now look at him representing his county, and his story is brilliant. It's an interesting time. I think it's changing. Everything's changing quickly in this country. And I suppose the message I want to get out is that we need to lift our eyes and make conversations. We need conversations to keep ourselves going. We need to make a little bit more effort to say hello and start a normal conversation, and not to start the conversation like, where are you from? Obviously, and that's something I found on the series, that if the person doesn't look like us, doesn't have the same color skin, that doesn't mean they're not Irish. And that's a big statement to make in this country in 2021. And that really annoys people when people go, where are you from? And then they turn out, I'm Irish, but you don't look Irish. But that doesn't mean I'm not Irish, because there's over 500,000 people born in this country who don't look Irish, who are Irish.
Yeah. And like, the other thing we need to get our head around is that, and by the way, I do think that people will leave the show. Like, we were chatting away in the office earlier on about the Russian guy down in Kerry. I think everybody leave the show with their own, their little favourites. I can't recommend watching it enough. Like, we do have to accept as a society as well, in any society, that like, when you have an influx of people, it's right that obviously a number will come in and they will be huge contributors to society. There'll be employers, there'll be elite sports people, and there'll be all that kind of thing. But like, you don't just draft in a section of, you know, elite people. There's always going to be people who have issues, health issues, mental health issues. There's the full range. And as a society, I think that's going to be an important one for us to get our head around, because we tend to shine the spotlight on those, let's call them negative stories. And that tends to become the conversation then. That tends to be the thing that allows people to give voice to their slightly racist views or whatever it might be. So I think that's something we need to get our head around.
And maybe Adrian, and people think that they're taking something from us. Like, I mean, if you look at that, the seven or eight guests we had there last night, that Latvian family in Mullingar, they've now got their own. He started working in a mushroom factory. He came picking mushrooms. His wife followed. Their kids speak Irish. The daughter works in financial services. They've all been schooled and educated here. They speak the local language and they speak Irish and they speak English and they speak Latvian. He has now got his own construction company. The Lord Mayor of Wisconsin, who's a very wealthy man, gave up everything to live on Sheep's Head. Patricia from Ghana gave 35 years of her life to the hospital. I'm working with people with head injuries in Dublin. All these people have contributed. They all have their own stories and they all have contributed to the economy of this country, and they've all brought something to the economy of the country. I mean, you know, there are a couple of my guests that have escaped war-torn places like Syria, and some people have to escape from Palestine. There's some great stories coming up, but not everybody who comes to this island is coming here with nothing, and they have nothing to offer. There's so much to offer, and so many people who just want to get here for a variety of different reasons. Economically, and getting a job is a very fundamental, and that's a very thing. But an awful lot of the people that came here, that young lad from France, all he wanted to do, Pierre, was get to the best pike fishing lake
that
in Europe.
That was incredible.
Did you know we have the best pike fishing lake in
Europe? I did not.
We don't know these things. We drive by Loch Derg and go, it's great, we'll stop for a pint. Meanwhile, he's spending 220 days on Loch Derg fishing for the greatest pike in the world. And it was pouring rain. And he said, from France, he's a Frenchman, and we all think the grass is greener. Oh, well, you've left a lovely climate and a lovely food and lovely people in France. No, I'm in heaven here, he said. I'm in paradise. This, to me, is the greatest pike fishing lake in Europe.
And this is the really interesting thing, Hector, I suspect, as we watch this season, is about how much we learn about our own country and how much having a hugely multicultural society will benefit our country. And I know it's not about rural Ireland, this show, but certainly just from that one episode, that the one thing I certainly took from it was that interview with Victor Beda, as Adrian mentioned there, the guy from Russia who learned Irish in Russia and came over and is now a local language officer in South Kerry. And you interviewed him on the beach in Ballinskellig, which is where my mother is from. We spent a lot of time down there. And whenever I was a child down there, I always used to think to myself, God, who even goes to school here? There's like two kids in every class and it's getting lower and lower and lower and people are just leaving the area in their droves. And then I think a few years ago, Hector, they went multi-denominational, and I think they were the first school in the Gaeltacht to do so, to get out of the clutch of the Catholic Church. You've got a guy from Russia coming into the area to promote the Irish language, and all of a sudden the place is kind of breathing again. And I wonder if you throw COVID into the mix, are we going to start to see a little bit of a reversal of that childhood idea of being like, geez, who would want to live down here? This is in the back arse of nowhere.
Yeah, it's a nice point. What a magnificent beach. I was never, ever down in that neck of the Gaeltacht down there. And it was absolutely spectacular. Beautiful scenery. And to see that, you know, he was down there amongst the people, Victor Beda, his Irish was magnificent. But as you say, that maybe those little communities are going to get a reboot. Maybe with the hybrid working of people can work from their laptop if they have their Wi-Fi now. And I just think it could be a great time for rural Ireland. I've heard stories of really good restaurateurs and young chefs in Dublin with young families who've decided to go back to their home parishes in Donegal and places, and they're going to open their own restaurants. That can only be a good thing if people can get out of the city. And we all know over the last 2 to 3 days, in the last week alone, what Dublin is. Dublin is collapsing under the monetary, under this broken rental house sale system. Nobody can buy a house in this country. It's an absolute disgrace. No young couple can buy a house, or young people who want to get on the first rung of the ladder. So I said across the water is broken, but there's serious issues here. But if people can move down the country and go to these parishes and assimilate and find work and be happy in the fresh air of a rural place, it's brilliant. But Victor was fantastic, and it just shows you that anyone can learn a language. It doesn't matter what part of the world you're in, it doesn't matter what language it is, it takes practice. Practice makes perfect. I mean, I went to Bilbao with nothing. All I could say was arriba, arriba, ondale, ondale. After 4 or 5 years in Bilbao, I immersed myself with living with locals in an apartment where no English was spoken. And I'm so proud that I can speak Spanish fluently now. And languages open up the world. And all of the guests that I had, wasn't it beautiful last night to see that family from Mullingar, 20-something years, and they bought a lovely house outside Mullingar, that their young daughters were able to mix between English and Latvian and Irish. And that's fantastic.
Yeah. I was looking at it. There was great Westmead stuff, so you tick the box for me, Hector. This lad is obviously on about Kerry. I think everybody around the country is going to be like, oh, deadly, he's arrived in our place and shining a really positive light on things.
Yeah, yeah. And we've cricket stories in there. We've Finn Harp stories in there. We've GA stories in there. We've got a windsurfer from Sardinia who decided to fall in love. He fell in love with Ballybunion. He was working in Dublin. He was always into windsurfing. Lorenzo Cubedu, and he's living in Ballybunion. He's working in Super Value. He got washed away on his board about 2 years ago on a bad winter's day on the swell in Ballybunion. And, you know, he spent 17 hours out at sea. Everyone thought he was lost. He got washed up 11 miles away on the coast of County Clare. It's an amazing story because he really thought he was gone, clinging onto a board for 17 hours in the Atlantic at the end of November. And to talk, the way he talked as we watched the waves crashing in on the beach in Ballybunion, I said, but Sardinia is beautiful, tranquil Mediterranean waters. It's hot summers. It's beautiful food. And he goes, no, that might be your, I know I have that. But this to me is the real sea. I've never been happier than watching these waves crashing in on the west coast of Ireland in Ballybunion. So, you know, I think it's going to give us a real juxtapose of our attitudes towards our country. Sometimes we take it for granted. Yes, we give out about the rain, but we really need to realise this is a great part of the world to live in. We're lucky by the grace of God to live on this island, and we have to make do what we have to do and just get on with it.
Great. Well, looking forward to the rest of it. I have to say, the anybody who tops the Russian, do you know what it was? It was the bit of Russian that kept, like, I think if you had no context of the show, right, you would listen to it. And maybe you'd never bat an eyelid. But knowing it, there was this little bit of Russian that kept sort of accent that kept coming in on his Irish. It was beautiful.
No, but he was a real scholar. You have to take your hat off this guy. Mm-hmm. Like, he studied in Trinity. He picked a minority language. The way he spoke about, everybody can learn Spanish or French. Everyone does that. Everyone learns German. And he's right. Yeah. But then he said, he was interested in the minority languages. And then he said, where can I go to speak a minority language that I like? And obviously in Moscow, that's the thing we forget. Jack McFinn from the Gray Logan Lucan, he did an honours degree in mathematics and Irish in Notre Dame. So all over the world in these brilliant, brilliant, huge universities of high standing, there are Irish academies all over the world where people from the country that they're in are learning Irish as the language. So he was attracted to a minority language, but now he's attracted to living in a magnificent part of the world, speaking Irish naturally, speaking Irish with the locals, speaking Irish in the shop, and he walks out his door and he's in South Kerry. I mean, that's a match made in heaven for him. Language, sense of place, geographical location, a sense of community, and in the middle of it all, he has his language, the language of the people, and the language of the people that was spoken for thousands of years.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You kicked it off in Navan. Are you going back to Navan before the series is out, or what's the plan?
Yeah, we'll be doing that. there's loads of stories. We've got some great stories coming up, and there's some really great stories, love stories and sad stories and happy stories. And a girl from Argentina, Fernanda Gonzalez, who as a child used to write a diary in Buenos Aires, and she was born on the 27th floor of an apartment block, and she listened to the Cranberries and loved U2, and she always wanted to come to Ireland because of the castles. As a young child, she'd write her diary thinking she was a princess in an Irish fairy tale, and she's 20-something years here now. She's fallen in love. She lives in Cork. And she said the music of U2 as a teenager growing up in Argentina and the Cranberries, she used to cry listening to the Cranberries. She couldn't wait to get to Ireland. She could recite every single lyric of a U2 song. Class. I mean, we sat there talking about Unforgettable Fire and War, the albums. We started singing Sunday Bloody Sunday. And to hear this girl, she knew every single lyric, like we all did back in the day. But she's so happy to be living in Ireland. And she took out her diary that she wrote as a 14-year-old and all about dreaming of going to Ireland and living in this amazing country. And her dream came true.
I was asking that pointedly because I think you were in with my mother-in-law at some point or another, so I'm looking forward to see if she appears at some point or another.
Say that again, Adrian.
You were in with my mother. You've interviewed my mother-in-law at some point or another. I'm not sure if she's actually going to appear on the show or not.
On this show?
Yeah.
What was that about?
In China Garden. Yeah. China Garden.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Michelle.
Michelle.
I had heard a rumour and I never put two and two together. And so, I think I know most things in Navan, but Michelle is one of the stalwarts of business in Navan. I mean, for a restaurant to be going for over 40 years in Navan, we were only in it a couple of weeks ago. It is absolutely magnificent. My young boys, they're 17 and 15 now, and as kids, we were going up going, Dad, Dad, in the back of the car as we travel through. And we travel through Longwood or on the way to Kinnegad, Dad, Dad. Dad, yeah. Are we going to the China Garden? Said, yes, we are, boys. Yes, we are.
I'm the same.
Chinese ever in Navan, man. It's an institution. And as you go into the China Garden, all you hear is that great Navin welcome. Well,
Hector. They're brilliant. About 10 years later, I'm still the same driving up the road, Hector. There's no getting away from it.
You know what a sun supper is then? A sun supper in the China Garden after a few pints is legendary stuff.
Not to be beaten. Hector, best of luck with it. It's if the stars aren't to go by, it's going to be an absolute cracker for the rest of it. Best of luck. Thanks, Willie, for joining us.
Lovely to talk to you boys this morning. Gormila Moggy, Mass More.
Carmel, I got it's Hector Hook gone 9:30. TG Carr Thursday nights. It's Aaron Nua, and it's a great show. And definitely recommend that you check it out. Right, thanks to Gillette, we're celebrating the return to normality with a special prize. We've been telling you all week: UEFA Champions League tickets. It's Chelsea against Malmo on October the 20th. We've flights and accommodation included for that. We've two prizes, both of which are going to be given away today, and you can enter the competition. Just head along to the Off the Ball Twitter page. We're going to be posting an image, as you can see in front of you there, of we won't tell you who it is. Probably the hardest one of the week, actually. It's a bearded sports person every day this week, and you just respond to that post by tell us who you think that person is, and you will be in the hat to be today's entrant to possibly go in and win one of those amazing prizes at the end of the week. So put your hashtag best face forward with Gillette. That's pretty much it for Friday's OTB AM. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Keep an eye on OTB Sports Radio across the day. Off the Ball live again from 7 o'clock this evening. There's a lot more coming up on Off the Ball over the weekend as well. Peter Schmeichel is going to be on Off the Ball Saturday tomorrow for the very special conversation with John Duggan. We can review the Saturday panel. Kenny Cunningham is going to join Danny and John for and Johnny as well for football chat all across the afternoon. Sunday then the pay-per-view, as well as live commentary of both Tottenham against Villa with Bernard O'Toole and Brian Kerr on that one, and then Liverpool Manchester City with Nathan and Kenny right now. And thanks to you all. Enjoy your weekend.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.